Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
If you're so concerned about violence, when Black Lives Matter organizers, the second day that they were protesting, were confronted by the police outside of the police station, and the police came in hazmat essentially suits, like these big suits that look like you're like going to be handling some serious chemicals, and they came and they dumped chemicals on the fire that the protesters were using to keep warm, except the chemicals got all over the protesters and all over their clothes and all over people's bags. Well, that seemed pretty violent. When police punched and kicked and shoved people, mostly women, out of the way in order to get to that fire, to put it out, in order to get to the tents that people were sleeping in to dismantle them, that was actual violence. So why aren't you guys as concerned about actual real-world violence that happens as you are about a tweet, which right. actually says, I don't want to be violent? That's where the media, I think, really got exposed. And if I may say so, the media in this city showed a great lack of empathy for Yusra Kogali. Why do I say that? Because Yusra actually received actual death threats after all of this became a story, where people called her violent, called her hateful, and then began to send her rape threats. And these are all public things that people can still go on Twitter and Facebook and find.
People didn't say, oh, Lord, give me the strength to not hurt Yusra. People said, I'm going to. They were direct, illegal death threats.
Where was the empathy? It was almost as if to say that Yusra deserved to be receiving. And if the media was actually concerned about online threats, which they were classifying her tweet as, now I don't agree it was a threat, but if they were actually concerned about online threats,
why is one threat newsworthy and not the other? Okay,
correct.
But we got to back up though, because we haven't answered the question, or at least attempted to. The media largely ignored Black Lives Matter as a live protest in our city night after night. The media had a lot of time and a lot of interest in your thoughts on this tweet. Is Yusra going to kill somebody? Is she threatening to kill somebody? Is this movement legitimate? So, why, in your opinion, is one thing a news story and the other thing not?
Because the media in Canada is trying to uphold white supremacy. And it is doing that by attacking people who threaten white supremacy.
Okay. So, when you say white supremacy,
yeah,
you know what people think of?
Yeah.
What do they think of?
Hoods and Nazi salutes and people dragging someone behind a truck or burning a cross.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, I think, feel like, that's crazy bullshit. That's radical. That's not me. That's not Canada.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't – that's – so I think that that is such a loaded term.
No, it's not.
To say – well, I mean, it's loaded with that. It's loaded with that imagery, right? We good Canadians all agree that the KKK are very bad and that that's what people ran away from to come to this wonderful country. So when you say that the media is trying to uphold white supremacy, I know that you have a very different understanding and interpretation of what that means. But that is incendiary. It's an incendiary, like, you know, like that does.
I really hope so.
So
I really hope that when I say that, it provokes people. Because white supremacy is very simply the idea that whiteness should be dominant in this part of the world. That even though white people are not from this part of the world, Jesse, that their laws and ideas and customs and traditions should be what govern this part of the world, because their way of doing things is better than other people's ways of doing things.
But to a person, that's almost indistinguishable from the guys in sheets. If you say that the editor who commissioned the story on the tweet now has to consider themselves someone who's trying to uphold white supremacy in Canada. Yeah. They don't think that that's them.
That's their problem. They need to look into their heart and ask themselves why, when a young woman who is out here fighting for justice and fighting for racial equity, why when she gets death threats? This is somebody, Yusra Kogali is one of the most peace-loving people that I have met. Because when she was angry about the society that she lives in, she went and organized a peaceful protest that drew thousands of people who came and sang and chanted and danced and shared stories with one another and bonded with one another and asked for justice through the democratic process. That's what she did when she was angry. These are all very peaceful actions. We should be encouraging somebody like that in our society, but instead, when she received death threats for a fake controversy, no one in the media had her back. So, Jesse, you tell me, why is it that people did not care at the death threats and all of the harassment that this woman was receiving, unless they believed that in some way it's just desserts, that in some way this is what you get when you say things on the internet? It was a game to our media.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, May 4th, 2016. So I have been told we should be here. I believe we should be here tomorrow as well as Friday with the book club. Third installment, Medical Apartheid, Harriet Washington. Looking forward, very constructive read. If you missed the first two sessions, they're in the archives. I would certainly encourage, whether you listen in, participate in the book club or not, I would highly recommend that folks read Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid. Incredibly informative, constructive, comprehensive book. On white supremacy and what black people have been subjected to in the field of healthcare in this area of the world. Phenomenally important. I think you'll learn a lot. Should be required reading. Any black person who's serious about addressing racism, certainly any black person, I would say if you're going to be a medical student, it should also be required reading. That's it. Program for today. The audio clip you heard at the beginning, Mr. Desmond Cole, black male journalist in Canada. I'll have a tad more to say about that clip as we move forward. He was talking about this Twitter controversy. Black Lives Matter Toronto, one of their co-founders, she's supposed to be a guest on the program today, Yusra Kogali, black female. She's been working diligently for months now, really for a long time, but specifically with what they've been doing, Black Lives Matter Toronto, and addressing police terrorism in Canada, and what happened with Andrew Locu and Jermaine Carby and many other victims of racism in the Toronto area, Canada at large. She was our scheduled guest for the program today. She had unforeseen circumstances and had to cancel, so she will not be with us. I posted online on Facebook when I found out this afternoon, so folks, I know people were looking forward. We have listeners in Canada who were looking forward to hearing her on the program and discussing some of these issues, but she won't be here. Sorry for the folks who were bummed out and looking forward to hearing additional details from her. But that was Desmond Cole discussing this whole Twitter controversy. We brought it up on the program before, where she made a tweet, basically, I think in February during Black History Month, that I'm paraphrasing, it said, please Allah give me strength not to cuss hyphen kill these men, white folks, today. That was her tweet. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much the gist of what she said. And white people in Canada waited about 2 months into the protesting and what have you around Black Lives Matter Toronto and Andrew Locu and how they were handling the police killing of this black male that happened July 4th in 2015 to bring up this tweet. And this is just, it's continued, spiraled out of control. Before I get to some of the comments that I had around that, really the only reason that we decided to broadcast, even though our guest is not going to be with us, is because I know sometimes people do not see the updates. It was kind of short notice. I found out, as I said, just a couple hours before we were scheduled to go live, that she was not going to be with us. So I just in an effort to explain so that folks knew what happened and why we weren't doing the program, to minimize confusion, I just said, we'll go ahead and broadcast. That way I can explain what happened, give a quick commentary. If folks have anything that they would like to get in, they can do that as well. Before I get into some of those details, the audio clip that folks heard before the exchange with Desmond Cole, I've played it before. It was from 2013 NPR. They did a segment on the implementation of the zip code system in the United States, the last five digits that you add to an address if you're going to mail something. And I've played that clip before. And the reason that I've played that clip on this program, if you heard it, obviously it doesn't directly have anything to do with racism, white supremacy. But I added Dr. Cambon at the end. I added it because I spoke with Dr. Cambon off the air. He's been on the program many times through the years, KamalCambon.org, his website. And he was saying that one of the primary things that we're going to have to do in terms of replacing white supremacy with justice is behavior modification, not with whites. I have no expectation at all that white people are going to discontinue the practice of racism. They are not going to alter their behavior. If anything, they will just refine and improve how they go about the business of terrorizing black people, non-white people on the whole. It's non-white people. We are going to have to change our behavior and figure out things that we can do, say, how we change our thought, speech, action to neutralize racists permanently. That's where the change has to come. And I play that segment because, I mean, when you're talking about changing the way that victims of racism respond, you're talking about centuries, generations of terrorism that influences the way that people think, the way that people behave. This is actually a program that we should have coming up next week on Monday. Josh Gibson, he's been on the program many times. We've talked about his books. He's an independent black publisher, has authored many, many books dealing with racism, white supremacy. But that's the book that we're going to discuss, how racism has changed the human brain for white people and victims of racism. And I think it's really important to keep that in mind. I play that clip, as I said, to hear how upset and difficult it was to get people to adjust just to the zip code. In fact, even within that clip, they said that the phone service told the postal service that you're going to have problems with this because we just added area codes, just three digits, and people flipped. They were furious about having to remember an extra three digits in order to make a phone call. So if you're asking people to remember an extra five digits, they are going to be outraged, which seems to be the case, that they had to get these corny songs and, you know, this big campaign just to get people to include an additional five digits on whatever parcel they were attempting to mail to make it easier. And so in my view, we're talking about racism, white supremacy, which has conditioned our responses in an infinite number of ways, how we think of and relate to other black people, how we think of and relate to white people, how we think of and relate to ourselves. I mean, it is, yeah, man, this has been going on, as I said, for generations. The system of white supremacy is older than the postal system in this area of the world. So I think it's critically important to keep that in mind in terms of what it is that we're trying to do. That's one of the main reasons that this program, we do the prayer. When I do the prayer at the end of the program, I include every time to be patient with other victims of racism and to be patient with ourselves, because I know a lot of times we end up being frustrated because we're being terrorized, mistreated on a constant basis in ways that we probably don't even fully grasp. And so we're just in a constant state of frustration about what's happening to us. And although a lot of times it's very easy to get frustrated with other black people, it's common to get frustrated with other black people, including ourselves, to try as best we can to just acknowledge where that frustration is coming from and to minimize taking out our frustrations on other victims, and to just try to be patient. It doesn't mean to allow for to excuse when non-white people mistreat you or do incorrect things, but just try to put those behaviors or misbehaviors, even if that's what's happening, to put that in context, and particularly if we have a problem with how other victims of racism are responding to white terrorism. Just something I think is very important to keep in mind. That said, and in fact, very much related, I can only say again, I've said this on the program in the 7 years that we've been here. I've said this quite a few times. It is crucially important, if you are serious about racism, white supremacy, and you attempt to do anything, if you're going to try to speak out with other family members, friends, write a blog, write a book, do a film or a YouTube channel, anything like that, videos, podcast, anything, any content that you're trying to do, any effort that you're trying to do against racism, white supremacy, it is, I think, critically important to remain focused. The problem is white people. It is very easy, and racists will offer you many opportunities to get distracted and frustrated, focused on other victims of racism that you don't like, or you disagree with the position that they've taken on racism, white supremacy, or just anything to get refocused away from white people. Yes, they might be the problem, but we want to take the next half hour or 5 days or 2 months or 5 years to gripe, grapple, tussle, argue with other black people. They have used this tactic strategically and very well for a long, long time. And I think it's really, really important. There have been so many opportunities here on the context of white supremacy where we could have been diverted to focus on other victims of racism who do not personally like Gus or the program or even callers on the program. And so they take that out on Gus. There have been so many opportunities for years for that to happen. And I can only say, again, the problem is white people. I mean, if you're talking about a war, a conflict where there is a problem, man, white people are more than enough. I guarantee you, if you really understand or even begin to seriously understand and get some accurate sense of the nature of the war being waged against black people, non-white people globally, that will occupy your full attention. You will not need any further conflict, any further strife to engage your mental abilities, to engage your time and energy. It is a full-time occupation just trying to figure out how to deal with white people and everything that they're doing to us and the consequences of all of that. That will be more than enough to occupy your full energies. I say that because this happened recently with me, with someone. I don't even know this person, and I'm not, you know, putting names out and all that, because again, this just be another opportunity to divert where they were not pleased with some of our efforts or something that I had done. They were not pleased, and in my opinion, were just very rude in how they talked to me. That's why the book we did for the book club, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. That's one of the things that he talks about that I thought was extremely important, the way that you go about talking to people. I certainly do not say that I'm perfect. I have made many errors, probably making 5 or 12 just during this program, during the last 5 minutes or so. But it is very important the way that we approach people. And I think that's one of the things right there in terms of racism, white supremacy, and behavior modification. Really being mindful about the way that we talk to other black people, even if it is to address a problem, something that you perceive the person is doing incorrect, or if they really are in error and misbehaving, doing something that they should not be doing. It's very important. And I say that because in this system, black people are accustomed to being talked down to, threatened, intimidated. I mean, that's our everyday 24/7 reality worldwide as black people. That's what we experience. We're accustomed to that. We're encouraged, really. The entire world is encouraged to relate to black people in that way. No good, life unworthy of life, as Dr. Welsing proudly said. Abused, shiftless, lazy, incompetent, ignorant, criminals, miscreants. That's the way the entire world is encouraged to think of black people. So, I think a lot of black people get tired of being talked to that way. And so I would really encourage, if you feel like, hey, I think this person is doing something incorrect, or I need to talk to them, I want to address something, really be mindful in the way that you go about talking to them. One of the things that I even encourage is to think, now, would I be talking to a white person like that? I suspect frequently, if we really thought about it, we're honest with ourselves, a lot of times the way that we talk to black people, we would not talk to a white person like that, because we know consciously, subconsciously, they have a lot of power. The way we've been conditioned to think about, treat white people, very different, vastly different from the way that we have been conditioned to think about, talk to, treat black people. Really keep that in mind. If I would be calm, respectful, I wouldn't be yelling and cursing at a white person if I was going to address a problem with them, exact same problem, identical circumstance, maybe I shouldn't be wigging out and cursing and talking down to this black person like they're the most incompetent, stupid person in the world. At any rate, the personal situation that happened with me, I will only say this could have been a grand opportunity. I could have, you know, identified the person by name and talked about all this and griped about them and did all that. It's totally unnecessary. And I will even add, this was related to economics and black business. This would have been an easy opportunity because I really don't have a problem. And I think I will stand by my work in terms of black people that are doing constructive things, whether it's writing, publishing, hair care products. We have talked about documentary films. We have promoted a ton of black people who are doing things, business ventures over the years. We have promoted a ton of them over the years. If all they had said was, is there any way that, you know, you could let people know about what it is that we're doing, services that we're on. No problem. I don't know these people. I certainly don't feel like I'm obligated to go and seek out and find as many black businesses as I can to see if I can promote. But certainly if they had approached me, no problem. I would have done that. But that's not the way that they came. It was very condescending, very nasty, very rude. And I told this person, I'm pretty sure that you would not have spoken to a white person in this manner about the same issue that was being raised. So I can only implore, be conscious about the way that you go to talk to other black people. Be patient about the way that you go to talk to other black people. And I've had this happen repeatedly where black people have come and just been real out of pocket, real rude, real nasty in talking to me about something where it wasn't even a big deal, where I would have been, you know, more than willing to accommodate whatever it is that they wanted, if it was promotion or whatever it is that they, you know, whatever problem that they were trying to address. It was not a concern at all. I didn't have, you know, a disagreement with their logic or their position, but the problem came in just them talking really nasty to me. And again, these are people that I don't know. I don't have any personal contact with these folks. So just get that in again, be patient with other black people, be mindful, and even resist the urge to retaliate. Again, that's why I'm not putting names out there. It would be easy for me to name these folks, and there have been many instances like this over the years. Resist the urge to retaliate. That's one thing that I can say. Lesson I picked up, Dr. Martin Luther King. Tavis Smiley did a biography on Dr. King, kind of the last year of his life leading up to when he was assassinated. And that was something that he employed all the time. People can ridicule and disagree about Dr. King's stance on nonviolence. One thing that I can say, he did tend to apply that to other black people. And there are many instances in Tavis Smiley's biography where black people were ridiculing and talking bad and just attacking Dr. King, and he did not retaliate. I'm not saying every time, but there are many instances over that last year that are documented where this happened. He did not respond. Stay focused on the problem. I would say that is a plus. And in my view, that is a great illustration of black self-respect, that even in tough times, even, you know, when I have been provoked and feel like this person has been talking bad to me, I'm still going to make my best effort to exhibit Black self-respect. I'm not going to make this into a big strife and conflict thing. If something needs to be said, I will address this person privately, say whatever needs to be said, and try to do it in the most respectful, courteous manner that I can, and then keep it moving. The problem remains white people. With that, a couple quick tidbits. We're not doing the full program. As I said, again, if people are just tuning in, our guest for the evening, Ms. Yusra Kigali, not here. Unforeseen difficulties, unfortunately. She will not be able to join us. Just wanted to make sure that we broadcast it so that people were not confused and, you know, thinking, you know, you said you were going to be on and then not on and what happened, that sort of thing, just so that people are aware of what happened. If you have any thoughts that you want to get in, you should get your hand up soon because we're not doing the full 3 hours. Things that I did want to make sure that were addressed, if there are listeners in the Arizona area, listeners, folks that are there who would like to have contact, phone call or email exchange, and then maybe y'all can meet in person to just have exchange of views and see if there's anything constructive that you could do. There are listeners in Arizona who would be interested. I think we've had listeners in Oklahoma, some other areas. I think even listeners in Toronto as well said they would be interested. I know we do have a contingent of Toronto listeners if folks are there. Just if you can email, and let's be codified on this one, if you can put in the subject contact Arizona or contact Arizona or wherever you happen to be at, that's what you can put in the subject. It will make it easier for me to just forward along if people are interested in meeting up with anyone for constructive purposes. I have heard good things from folks who have done this in some of the different areas, Florida, New York, where we have Washington, D.C., where we have Cal's listeners. So that's one. We had also a person listener who was interested. We did this before some years back on the program. If people are interested in doing role play, counter-racist role play here on the Cal's. And what that means is, I know a lot of times different folks talk about getting in scenarios either with white people or non-white people where they just have not had adequate training, adequate practice in figuring out the best thing to say and how to respond to different situations. So if you're, you know, something comes up about the election or something comes up on the job, something comes up about racism, something comes up about quote unquote interracial relationships, just figuring out, you know, how they would respond, the words to use, and just getting a bit more practice so they can improve how they handle those situations. We had a listener who expressed interest in doing that again. We did this before, as I said, on the program, some role play where people can, you know, dial in and pretend to be a white person so you can get some practice in figuring out how you would respond, what words to use, or just, you know, maybe a more confused victim and what words you would use in dealing with them. Maybe even some situations where we minimize conflict with other victims of racism. That might be important as well. Folks would be interested, let me know. That's something that we can make time for. I am not pleased about this. I think what is going to happen by June, I've been dragging my feet, and I'm using a metaphor just to emphasize that I never said do not use metaphors. I've just said on the Saturday compensatory call-in, no metaphors. At any rate, I'm purposely dragging my feet because I'm not pleased about this change, and I'll explain why. But by June, and I'm just doing that because, as I said, I'm dragging my feet. I really could have done this, you know, now. We could have done this week, but I'm not pleased about the change. We have greater participation during the compensatory call-in, which is good. I'm glad more people are willing to share their views, thoughts, observations. That is great. We have more participation during workplace racism. That is great. However, it is making the program longer than 3 hours, and it's seeming that on a pretty regular basis, people would have more to say during the first part of the program. We're just kind of discussing observations from the past week or so, people would have more to say. I think we've been giving people about 5 minutes and seeming like people would have more things to say or exchange. We used to be able to have a little bit of exchange about ideas. People would hear what other people were talking about and have additional comments they would want to bring up or questions, that sort of thing. We don't really have time for that because there's greater participation for both the workplace racism segment and the earlier segment. We're just kind of discussing what happened during the last 7 days. So I think eventually by June, again, I'm not pleased about the change. The workplace racism is going to be a separate program, probably Thursday. Sunday would also be an option, but I'd probably be leaning towards Thursday, where that will be the workplace racism program. If people are interested in doing the counter-racist role play, we can include that on the Thursday segment as well. But that would give additional time for folks if they have more comments that they would like to get in. More participation or questions, because that happens sometimes too, where people have questions about things where we would give more time. I'm not pleased about this because, number one, workplace racism is one that's been my observation, and this is based on years of participating and facilitating this broadcast. People are not excited, enthused about workplace racism. I've not quite figured out all of the dynamics around why people are not as eager to participate in workplace racism, either talking about problems, observations, things that have happened, and or triumphs. Again, if people have figured out some things that work well for kind of minimizing problems, that have worked well for, you know, getting racist stuff off of you, or even minimizing conflict with other non-white coworkers, it just, for whatever reason, for myriad of reasons, probably, people are not as excited about that. If we're going to talk about sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people, oh man. Everyone is down to talk, excited, eager. Workplace racism, not so much. People are already there. We've kind of locked in the compensatory call-in, same time, same date. It's a weekly program, so people kind of know that that's when, yeah, when to dial in. So we have great participation. It would kind of be restarting with workplace racism being on a separate day. My suspicion is that there will be a lot less participation. During that, they will have lots of crickets and people not being willing to share, which again is amazing to me because I just do not believe that you can get any collection of 10 black people together and not have anybody who's experiencing any problems on the job. I just do not believe that. Or even if it's not problems they personally are experiencing, things that they're seeing with other black people and or things, just observations about things that white people are doing on the job, incorrect things, or things that you know a black person would not be able to do. Just a myriad of things that would come up and be solid information, solid observations for workplace racism. I suspect that it will be challenging, but I might be wrong. It would be glad, I would be happy if that is not the case and we have great participation and folks are excited and ready to roll. When next month we move workplace racism to a separate isolated program. I guess in one sense, I should perhaps be pleased if we do have the participation that workplace racism, because it was really bad at first in terms of people just not participating and having nothing to share. Or I think sometimes it's not fun. I've said that, too. I think that's definitely one factor. It is not exciting to stand up before the class and talk about how we have been terrorized on the job. That is not a cool thing to talk about, but it's vitally important. I can only emphasize just because it's not just you. There's so many other people that are going through the exact same thing and or people learning who don't have the same extensive work history. They're younger, so they're just starting out with their career, to know the type of things to expect. And that way they can already start having some strategies in place about how to neutralize those problems before they happen. It's so beneficial. And just for you personally, even if that's a problem that you're experiencing, to be able, it can be cathartic to be able to explain what happened so you're not just holding on to it and being frustrated or depressed or angry about it, and then to work through problem solving. I think sometimes folks have good suggestions about ways to try to handle that. And if nothing else, as you continue, I think most of the people, regardless of how bad the problem is, their work history continues, and even if that means that they have to seek new employment. Okay, I know the error that I made here. This situation, next time I will do this. And these are lessons that I learned that I will take forward so that I can have fewer problems as I continue working under the system of racism, white supremacy. And I will encourage people that have their own businesses should definitely participate, because I have maintained, I hear that rhetoric a lot, that people are talking as though if you just become an entrepreneur, that will extinguish your issues with racism in the workplace. Nothing could be further from the truth. It will just change the way that you are dealing with workplace racism. But I can guarantee, and I don't say that very often, but I can guarantee I have no doubts. I know I'm accurate here. I know black people who own their own businesses. You are lying to yourself and anyone else when you say that. If you think just because you have a business, you're not going to have to deal with racism. Contraire, mon frères. At any rate, I'll make the announcement when we switch to another day, another date for the workplace racism segment. But that is coming. Dragging my feet. Moving forward. Quick things I will get in just about the Canada situation, Black Lives Matter Toronto, because I've been preparing to talk about that for the evening. I'm not sure if we will have a reschedule or not. And plus, I had told some of the folks that have been working diligently through very difficult and dangerous circumstances with Black Lives Matter Toronto, when they had asked me if I had been following the police situation with Andrew Locu and all that, and I told them, honestly, no, I haven't. And I added, I really don't follow, intently the police shootings and what have you that happen here in the States. I've said for years, I don't think it'll be a surprise to anyone who's been listening to the Cows for a long time, I'm really not interested in the police terrorism thing. It's just not something that I keep up with. It's something that you cannot keep up with. I mean, truth be told, so many black people are molested, abused, raped, killed, strangled, tased by enforcement officials worldwide. It is no way you could keep up with all the incidents of that happening. A lot of times this stuff doesn't even get reported. Just, you know, another nigga mauled by police. Next, that's not even news. That's not even worthy of being reported. Just on this program alone, the material that we did with the London riots in 2011, that was police terrorism. Mark Duggan, 3 years to the day almost, 2011, that Mike Brown was shot and killed in Ferguson in 2014, but that all started with a non-white male being shot and killed by enforcement officers in London that led to all the rioting and buildings being burned and everything that went on for quite some time in the summer of 2011. Certainly know in Brazil, we played quite a few news clips over the months, years really, of astronomical numbers of black people being savaged and brutalized and killed by enforcement officials in Brazil. I think we did the clip a few weeks back about Mexico. Same situation. I know Dr. Welsing has talked on the program about her being arrested when she was in Mexico. We have had Black Lives Matter Toronto members on this program before. If you were have been listening back in 2014, we had Pascal Daverlis. She was on the program when they were talking about Jermaine Carby. This is worldwide in terms of black people being mauled and abused by enforcement officers. And I was telling off the air some of the folks who've been working courageously with the Black Lives Matter Toronto protesters. And it wasn't, you know, a criticism at all. I have tremendous respect for what they've been doing, because they have brought a lot of attention to racism in Canada. I think our listeners have brought that up before, where a lot of times people don't think that there's racism in Canada. They just say, oh, it's in the States. We don't have that here in Canada. But they brought a lot of attention and got people using correct terms, white supremacy, and more focused, more serious about this problem. That's phenomenal. But what I said to her was that I just haven't seen any evidence that anything can be done about police terrorism against black people worldwide. And you can even include South Africa, because we talked about the Marikana mining situation as well, where the police killed astronomical killed, shot, mauled, molested astronomical number of black people. That was back in the summer of 2012. But I said, I just have not. And I have seen a myriad, and I mean for years, decades, where all kinds of strategies have been employed by black people. Marching, protesting, looting, destruction of property, and killing police officers. Whether it's Mark Essex, Lavelle Mixon, Christopher Dorner. It's a long list of that, where people even said, you know, hey, they're at war with us. Let's get busy and do the same. Even that. And I've seen no evidence that any of that has successfully solved the problem. You get it. To me, you can almost predict what's going to happen. Everything is done, regardless of what strategy is employed and how upset victims of racism get about police terrorism, some speeches will be made. This is a tragedy. Diversity, training. We'll have additional training, and we'll have community meetings. We will hire some colored enforcement officials, and we'll hope this tragedy doesn't happen again. Thank you. And then it will happen again in a matter of days or weeks or months. Even with this situation with Andrew Loku, the black male, he was shot and killed July 4th, 2015. Even with this situation, that looks like about the pattern. They said Premier Kathleen Wynne and other white officials in Toronto, they came out and said, you know, we're going to have training, diversity. We'll have a review. We'll have transparency. That's another one more recently. Transparency about what's been happening. Nobody ever gets fired for any of these shootings or maulings or rapings or what have you. Nobody gets fired generally. We'll have transparency. And then Monday, they released the report. They have an independent review, supposedly independent review body in Toronto that's supposed to review whenever there's police alleged police misconduct or a shooting or something like that. They review the case and they make a determination on whether they think charges should be brought. Now, this independent review body, I think it's the SIU, they do not have any powers to do anything. That's important as well. Like, they cannot fire anybody. They cannot charge anybody. They can just submit a report with suggestions. And then the police, they look at it and they make a decision about whether they're going to bring any charges or fire somebody. I could be in error, but I'm pretty sure that that's the case. This independent body, allegedly independent body, they don't have any power to, you know, terminate anybody or fire anybody or bring charges. So this report normally is not released publicly. So all the fantastic effort of the Black Lives Matter protesters, and this was one of the things that they were demanding to get this report released so that they could review the evidence themselves about this black male who was shot and killed by the police 2015, where the police said he had a hammer in his hand and he charged them and, you know, we got to kill him. We can't have random, you know, Negroes running around with hammers. And so they released the report. However, it's heavily redacted. It's 9 pages. The whole report is 34 pages. They released 9 pages that have been redacted, don't have the witnesses' statements and key witness testimony that allegedly contradicts what the enforcement official said. They leave all that out. They just give a few pages. And then even the clowning, they released this last Friday. So that's April 29th. They released this report on April 29th, almost a year after the shooting. They release it on Friday afternoon, not at the beginning of the day. They release it late in the day on a Friday. It's been my experience. I'm sure this is not just a Canada thing. Friday afternoon, people start checking out. That's generally the way the plantation works. People are not really paying attention and locked in for what's going down. And we're going to work until the last minute of the workday. It's time to get drunk. It's time to get our weed. It's time to get our heroin. Like, we will catch all you on Monday. So they released this redacted and edited report Friday afternoon. So this doesn't even get a lot of attention, which has been, you know, the whole pattern for most of this anyway, where the media didn't really, the white dominated press in Toronto, Canada on the whole, didn't really cover what was happening with these, with the protests and what have you, what Black Lives Matter Toronto had been doing. They really didn't get that much attention. Certainly not as much attention as our guest for the evening, her tweet, got. That was months ago. This was from February. Even in the audio clip that I played to start today, Desmond Cole, where he was talking on Canada Land about this report, that interview was from like 2 days ago. This was not old. They're still talking about the tweet. You just had this report come out with all these redactions and all these problems, and I thought we're supposed to have transparency and all that. They're not even talking about that. This was like a 40-minute interview. They devoted nearly the entire segment to talking about this tweet from 2 months ago. And I just said that's about what I would expect from racist white supremacists, where there's not going to be any, whatever they say at the end of the day, they might have a lot of great sounding words, rhetorical ethic, Dr. Marumba Ani's concept. They might have a lot of great sounding words and promises about we're going to get our act together. And this is a tragedy and we just can't have this sort of thing happen again. They might even hand out a few nickels. They've done that in a few cases. Marlene Pinnock, I think she got a few quarters. That was the black female grandmother who was in her 50s, who was just mauled by some white brute, California Highway Patrolman, if folks remember, in 2014. They gave Tamir Rice's family recently, gave them a few. They might even do that. But beyond that, whatever. We will be back on the grind beating down Negroes like immediately, soon, like in the next 5 minutes, like immediately. This is just what the system of racism, white supremacy produces. Just the whole incident, just in terms of the way that whites have responded to all this, has been clowning and just typical. If anything, I would say if you look not just in the States, but if you look globally at how they respond to these sort of incidents, I think you'll see a lot just about in terms of the patterns, in terms of how white people maintain racism, white supremacy, and just a lot of times just the total lack of respect that they have for black people on the whole. A lot of times it seems like they're not even really trying to hide the contempt that they have for black people. With the release of this report, with the non-indictments, just all of it, to me, it just seems blatantly like, yeah, okay, so we killed this nigger. Yeah, okay, if you're talking Oklahoma, yeah, okay, so this officer raped all these niggers. Okay, what are you going to do about it? We didn't release the whole report. What are you going to do about it? Nobody got charged. What are you going to do about it? Nobody got fired. What are you going to do about it? Do you have any power to stop us from doing it? I didn't think so. We'll be out doing it again. That's basically the way that it comes across to me, which is pretty. That's why I pretty much taken the position until the entire system is dismantled. You can just, look forward. This is just going to continue to happen over and over and over. The best you can do is try for it to not be you. For some people I know, they say that, well, that's taking a defeatist attitude and that sort of thing. It's not that at all. For me, it's just understanding what the system of white supremacy is. These are things that are just going to happen in the system of white supremacy. It is unfortunate, but that's what we're dealing with. Until all of this has been vanquished, the police are just going to continue to do this worldwide. And again, as I said, I think you can just check the record books. I have seen no example, and folks can certainly check Gus T if I'm in error, if I'm talking crazy, but I just have seen no evidence at all over well over 100-year period. I know Mr. Fuller talked about this a lot, where when he was asked about all this, when all this kicked up back in 2014 with Michael Brown and Eric Garner and blah, 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 and he said, this is business as usual. I've seen this for my whole life, really. He's in his 80s. He said, I have seen this my whole life. Nothing about this is unusual. Nothing about this is strange. Nothing about this looks different from what I have seen for decades. After all of this dies down, business as usual. They will just be back and doing whatever they do. And he said, you can just go and do the evidence. You can just go and read. You'll see reports about black people being mauled and killed by the police 1915, 1910, 1900. Even if there was a riot, even if there was a protest, as I said, even if the police were killed, even if, non-white people got upset and went out and committed counterviolence against the police, it just ends up often becoming justification for increased violence against black people. That's what happened in New Orleans. Mark Essex, black male, he was tired. He was a member of the Black Panther Party and a veteran. He went out and specifically began killing enforcement officials in New Orleans. I think he killed like 5 or 6 police officers. And all it produced, I think they changed the laws. I think they might have even reinstituted the death penalty. And said, we're going to put these Negroes in place. And they just went on a campaign of brutalizing black citizens in New Orleans. I think that's about what happened. I know we talked about that in 2011, where we had Dr. Moore. He's a professor in Louisiana. He wrote a book about racism and policing in New Orleans. And he talked about that situation with Mark Essex specifically. Last quick comment I'll get in with regards to the Andrew Locu situation in terms of just the typical tacky things that racists do. It was the same thing if you look at some of these other incidents where they will say, well, this black person had such and such in their system. They were intoxicated or they were high. They released that as well with Andrew Locu and saying that he had a lot of alcohol in his system and, he might have had some mental trauma from his experiences in the Sudan where they had all this strife and civil war. But we don't think that was the issue. We think he was just, wound up on all this, alcohol. And that's why he was noncompliant. That's why he didn't put the hammer down. And that's why we had to shoot and kill this Negro. Anyway, that's standard operating procedure that they're going to do. Either the black person was high, they were drunk, both, whatever the case may be, in some way, shape, form, you deserve this tragedy. We'll have some training, diversity training. We'll say a vigil, transparency. We'll hire a few niggers and moving forward. At any rate, and again, if folks have, you know, anything to the contrary where they have seen that any strategy, and I mean anything, works to stop police from doing this anywhere in the world, please dial in and let Gus T. Renegade know that I am talking crazy and giving out inaccurate information. One other thing, I will get in. I'll check the phone line if folks have anything else that they want to get in. One thing that I for sure think is coming, just in terms of how the system of white supremacy, the massive imbalance of power that whites have, what I think you're going to see, I think I said on the program, I've said it a few times, I know I said it recently, last week, as it's been reported in the United States specifically, that there is a growing percentage, non-white percentage of the population in the U.S., and that white people are anxious about this. I know Dr. Welsing talked about this. I know Jane Elliott has been on this program, admitted white supremacist. She talked about this with the book The Birth Dearth. I think it's Ben Wattenberg, a white author, who talks about this. We don't have enough white people making babies. I think Dr. Mazama, phenomenal guest. She was on the program last week, and she talked about how by 2020, there will be more non-white children in this area of the world than white children, if that's not the case already. And I said, I think you're going to see massive numbers of white people who are going to disinvest, divest from anything, public infrastructure. We don't want to contribute our white tax dollars to anything, public schools, public health care, welfare, anything like that. We don't want to contribute our tax dollars to have all these dark people, you know, using public services. I think you can also include in that police departments. Now, some people might say, great, we don't need a Ferguson Police Department anyway. We don't need NYPD anyway. All they do is go around and brutalize and terrorize black people. Okay, this is what I think you're going to have. They will probably, and I would say, just look, this might be something that's on the horizon. This might be one that I could be a little bit ahead of the curve. This might be one that's maybe in the next 10 to 20 years. I think this is going to start happening. When they start divesting from the police departments, where you have a massive drop in the number of enforcement officers, or they totally eliminate a police department on the whole, what I think you're going to happen, it's already starting to happen here in Seattle, Virginia. I've seen other areas where this is popping up. You will have either armed more, you already have this, but an increased number of armed white citizens. We can just make it like the old West, or you will have private police operating in neighborhoods. And they already have that here in Seattle, where rich white people, they just get off-duty enforcement officers. I think what will happen when they start defunding police departments or eliminating them, you will have white people who have the resources. They will just go and hire former police officers to be private security for their area. I think someone mentioned about the continent and studying what's happening in South Africa specifically. I think you already have this in different quote-unquote countries on the continent, not just South Africa. I think this is in Kenya as well. And I think President Obama talked about this in Dreams from My Father, where you have all these private gated communities where the white people stay and they have their armed private security to keep them safe. And I know in South Africa, this was popping up as a problem because these armed white people, in protecting their neighborhoods, were shooting black people who were coming. Sometimes it would be a black person who was coming to work there, or the offspring of a black person who was employed there as a nanny or what have you, to clean and cook for them or what have you. This was happening in South Africa, and we talked about this. I think you're going to have the same thing to happen here, and I don't think it's going to be an improvement at all, because you'll just have increased numbers of armed white vigilantes, militia members with their gun, their firearm, and any random nigger that comes through their neighborhood. I don't like the cut of his jib. I don't recognize this person, or I do recognize this person, but today I'm just, you know, I'm disgruntled and I'm ready to shoot a nigger. Bang. I think that's what you'll happen, but that's what I can kind of see on the horizon with the police issue, because I could totally see whites saying, you know, we've had it. You know, you all out running around in the street protesting, we've had it. These die-ins disrupting, we're trying to go to Starbucks, we're trying to go to the mall, and you all out here protesting with your signs and Black Lives Matter and, you know, yelling at our good citizens, Darren Wilson.
Daniel Pantaleo, these are law-abiding citizens. Timothy Lohman, we've had it with you all out here acting a fool, embarrassing us. Randall Carrick down in North Carolina, we've had it. Fine. You think the police are racist and they're out to get you? Fine. We'll do away with them. Now see how you like that. And then just sit back. Or I could see them doing this in areas where a lot of black people live with the suspicions people have raised about what's happening in Chicago, that they think whites are fueling a lot of the violence where they had these reports of black people dying and just blaming it on Negro hooliganism, that they think either white people are killing these people or white people directly, indirectly are doing things to create these murders, create this crime, so that they can just further stigmatize black people as being violent. And, oh my gosh, the black on black crime, you all are just killing each other. And, oh, this is a disgrace. You all got nothing on John Burge and Chicago Police Department. I could see them doing the same type of thing. We just, hey, fine, no problem. You're tired of the police? We'll take them out of your community and you just have at it. And then they'll just come and leak whatever into the community, whether it's, excuse me for saying community, they will leak whatever into that black residential area, whether it's guns, whether it's drugs, whether it's just having white people come in and commit crimes, kill black people, and then blame it on other black people. They have a myriad of ways that they can achieve the same result, and that's black people being terrorized. But that is one thing that I think is likely going to happen, and I guess I should offer a suggestion. I would, number one, if you're in an area like myself where it's predominantly white people, you might want to think about relocating. That might be the suggestion. If you're in an area where it's predominantly white people and you could see this happening, might be something to consider. If you're in a black area, it might be worth organizing. I know the militiamen, they were down in Ferguson after the unrest, after Michael Brown. I think this was particularly after they announced Robert McCullough and company that they were not going to indict Darren Wilson. And they had these white militia members there who were protecting property and armed white people patrolling and all that. And they were encouraging, hey, the police are not doing their job. They're not providing adequate protection. Do it yourself. Organize. You can get your guns. You can get your concealed carry permit. You can go out and train and just organize, meet your neighbors. It doesn't take a whole lot of work. Have, you know, a few meetings and you can organize patrols and what have you. You can take turns so it doesn't have to burden any one person or any two or three people unduly. You can organize and take turns. That's the same sort of recommendation that I would make for black people. Organize. You can take one meeting at the church. Black people are already there. Stop. Organize. You can have the same type of patrols to try to keep yourself as safe as possible. Black people did this before. This is one of the things the Black Panther Party did in the 60s and 70s that I think astronomical illustration of black self-respect. And it was very constructive. Probably one of the reasons that white people wanted to get rid of them quickly. But this is something that's been done before. That would be what I would recommend to do that. And this is something that could happen from the church. And I've even seen some evidence of that as well. There was a church in, I think it was Michigan, after the incident in South Carolina, the white terrorist assault at Mother Emanuel AME, where some black church members, they said, hey, we're going to protect our congregation. We have our firearms. We're legally authorized to carry them, and we're going to protect our church. You could just expand that thinking from the church to the neighborhood at large. Recommendation. With that, I will pause. If folks have comments they would like to share, feel free. Again, anybody, if you have evidence of anything to get enforcement officers to stop terrorizing, mauling, killing, raping, abusing black people, if you've seen evidence that something works long term and not just for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, but long term that stops this, then you should step forward immediately and spell it out in vivid detail. If you are interested in participating, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Thomas in New York, see your hand. Do you have any commentary you needed to get in, or are you just listening, sir?
Yeah, I had some commentary. Well, you did a great job with what you just spelled out. And, of course, I have a definite way to stop the police from harassing black people. But we would need to create, like, an invisible spray, something we could spray on us to be invisible. That's the only way. We could take a pill to make us white. That's the only two ways you could do it.
I don't see it working any other way. I had a few observations. First, on what you said earlier, I agree. I used to, as you know, and you always would correct me, I would often say bad things about black people, especially in the media. And you're absolutely right. You know, we tend to focus on black people as opposed to white people. And what I've learned is behind every Negro is usually a white person behind them, funding them, put them in the position they're in that has them there. And usually a Jew. They need to earn their white status, so they're usually the people they put in charge of us. And I try to now focus on looking up who's behind the person as opposed to the person, because I know they're usually they're doing it for a check, and white people are usually the people that cut those. I don't think we should be attacking people like yourself who do the work, who actively put out the show for everyone to listen to, and is doing the work. If someone wants to attack you, they should probably just not listen to your show. I think that would be the best thing. You know, even when you had Dr. Umar on last week, you know, some callers I thought were rude to him, you know, questioning him, saying they didn't want to donate because of whatever reason. But, you know, black people donate to white people all the time, never ask any questions, never ask where's the money going. They say they want it, they give it to them. There's plenty of black people who can just afford to buy a school and a campus who aren't doing anything. So I just didn't get why a lot of people was, you know, being rude to him. If they didn't agree with what he did, just don't donate to him. You know, I also piggyback off of what you said earlier. I'm constantly trying to polish up my definition of racism. And I think I got it narrowed down to just two words now. Just, you know, my definition of racism, white supremacy, is white people. That's the whole thing. They keep it all going. Last couple of things I just want to say real quick. You mentioned Mark Essex. I said it on the show before, you know, we need a Mark Essex movie where he dies at the end, but he dies like the hero, dies like the white soldier dies at the end of the movie, you know, just dies the hero death where, you know, you leave like, yeah, you know, I think that would be great. You know, rest in peace to Afeni Shakur. I wrote you yesterday. I think that this could be we could be seeing something soon about Asada being captured or turned over. Just talk to us about Malia Obama, some of the comments made because of she was going to Harvard. Somebody wanted to cut her skin off for her. I thought that was very interesting. And the very last thing is Trump. You know, your BFF is Amy Goodman. My BFF, Donald Trump. He's in position now to, hammer it home. And I think that we're going to be in for an interesting, very entertaining few months of political theater. And I just hope everyone's paying attention because we're going to see a lot of racism. And it won't be so codified either. It's going to be very, very much out in the open. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Right on. Yeah. Dr. Afeni Shakur passed away today as well. I'd said before, I don't really have, I'm never in position to be able to, if I have a prediction about something that's going to happen, something I think is going to take place, it's never anything to feel good about. It's never anything that I think is constructive or positive to black people that I have a prediction on. It's always something related to what I think or what I see whites have in store for us or how I see things evolving under the system of white supremacy. And with Afeni Shakur's death, we're really only like a third of the way through 2016. And this has been a pretty horrendous year, I would say. For black people on the whole, you could take the position that any year under the system of white terrorism is a horrendous year, but
man. Just catastrophic losses this year. And I would only contrast, because we have recently had years where a lot of black people transitioned who had worked against racism, white supremacy. I know 2014, when Dr. Maya Angelou passed, Ruby Dee also transitioned that year, Mary Baraka, Yoshi, I'm going to mispronounce her name, but it's Asian female, Yuri Kochiyama, who worked with Minister Malcolm X. It was a lot of people, a lot of black people who had devoted time, energy, working against racism, white supremacy. I'm not even naming everybody. I think Bobby Herman died that year as well. Herman Ferguson. I think he transitioned in 2014 as well. But there were a lot of people. But I guess the only difference that I would add is that a lot of those people were at least a little bit older, that they had more time to work against racism, white supremacy. It seems like some of the folks that we have lost this year, they were not that old. Even 69 is not that old. It's extremely unfortunate, in my opinion. And former member of the Black Panther Party, she was a lot more, Phinny Shakur, a lot more than just, oh yeah, that was Tupac's mom. Like, she had done a lot to work against racism, white supremacy, and the author of Drugs as a Weapon Against Us and the FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Males, Mark Patash. He was a guest on the program just at the beginning of April. He talks a lot about Phinny Shakur and just her dying from a heart attack. That right there is black mental health, because he talked in both books in great detail about the stress and terrorism that she was subjected to for her entire life. The work that she did in the Black Panther Party, she was a member of the Panther 21 case, worked on her own defense, where they ended up beating all the charges and getting out of jail, getting exonerated, getting an acquittal, continued harassment. He even suggests in the book that the same COINTELPRO forces, these white enforcement agencies, were the ones who were sending people in her life to get her addicted to these different poisons and what have you, so she would have a drug problem, so that she would not be continuing her activist work to neutralize her. All of that takes a toll. When we're talking about medical apartheid, all of that takes a toll on your black mental health. That is how you end up with black people not being around that long. 69, I mean, I think it's Ishaka Musa Varashango who talked about that. Black people dying at 69. Prince died at 57. That is a disgrace. Even Natalie Cole, she died at the beginning of the year. I believe she was 65. That is a disgrace. Minimum, if we were in a system of justice and not staggering and on all these medications and not in your right mind and not able to function and have high quality of life, that this is a disgrace what they have got us accustomed to accepting, the quality of life and the shortness to have a brief life of misery under white terrorism, that's what they've got us accustomed to accepting globally. It just a monumental disgrace. And just add this one to another, as I said, just a horrendous year. And I mean, we haven't even got to the election, as you mentioned. I am very convinced. I have been accurate in my predictions about the president for the last three presidential elections. I said President Obama was going to win in 2012. I said he was going to win that election in 2008. I've been accurate for the last three. I have struggled with this one because it just looks unpredictable. It just looks very unusual. And I think a lot of people have said that about this election. The last 2 weeks, I have become increasingly confident that it is going to be President Donald Trump, as the legend Dr. Francis Cress Welsing said. This week has only further solidified, yes, it is going to be President Donald Trump. Not that that's anything to, you know, be gleeful about under the system of white terrorism. But I mean, if anything, it should solidify, man, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, total genius. She was saying this way in advance, before anybody else was even taking him seriously as a candidate. She was saying, meet your next president based on her understanding of racism, white supremacy. She was light years ahead in terms of her understanding of white supremacy, which only further magnifies the monumental loss. But I know she would be looking at with a huge smile. It's just, that is what I said, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, theory of white genetic annihilation. I know what I'm talking about. Third generation physician, attempted counter-racist scientist. Let's see, Roz.
Hey, Gus, one more. Can I just add one more thing about Afeni Shakur?
Mm-hmm.
Last night, sir, I was ironing my kids' uniforms, and I put on my headphones, and I'm listening to Pandora, and I'm listening to old school hip hop. I'm listening to, like, on a Lord Finesse channel, and they played 4 Tupac songs. And I thought that was so odd, because, I mean, Pac wasn't even out when Lord Finesse was out. I usually keep things in that same year frame and other general artists. So earlier today, you know, I was mopping the floors, and I put my headphones on. I put on Pandora. So let me listen to something a little bit more modern. I think I put, like, a Lil Wayne station on, and they played 6 Tupac songs within a matter of 2 hours. And I thought that was extremely odd, you know, because I know, so I think it's like a 10-cent every time they play that song goes to the estate. And now that she's passed, it's a lot of money going to that estate. I would love to know who's in control of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Ross, if you had comments you wanted to get in, you should be with us as well.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Thomas in New York and all the callers and listeners. If there's not one thing that I've learned from more than anything else, is the serious issue that anti-blackness presents, to just piggyback off of what Thomas in New York was saying. It's like, we just don't realize that we have been so conditioned. It's like a Pavlovian response to ourselves, like how we see ourselves when we look in the mirror and how we see other people who look like us. And, you know, it's like a Pavlovian response where we're just so conditioned to hate ourselves that it just comes out in a myriad of ways, and you have to really, really work hard to be conscious of that. You know, I deal with that too. We all deal with that. But I just find that to be, like, the most profound aspect, self-destructive aspect of this system. And I think it's, like, the main engine that keeps it running, because that is the only way that such a small amount of people could dominate the largest group on the planet and do it so successfully and create the problems between different non-white groups and allow them to keep fighting amongst themselves while the puppet masters, which are the racist white supremacists, white people, continue to get away with what they've been doing for the, you know, last couple thousand of years. Just to speak on Prince, I read in an article that the doctor that he was seeing was actually an addiction specialist. I read a couple of articles on it, and that the doctor was supposed to be helping him with a serious addiction to painkillers. From what they said, from people close to him, that he had specific health problems. One or two of which required surgery, but because of his faith, he's a Jehovah's Witness, he refused to have anyone cut him. So I guess the answer to not getting the surgery was dealing with the pain through the painkillers. And this is what they're alluding to right now, even though the autopsy report won't be back for another four weeks. I think they said 4 to 6 weeks. So they were saying that that he had an addiction problem, but it was a byproduct of his religious faith, in which they don't believe in cutting your body, essentially. So that's something that I looked in a couple of places and saw it. So I'm just going to continue to watch how that develops and what else seems to come down the pike. In reference to Dr. Afeni Shakur, that was just really, it just threw me off when my wife had sent me the text about it. And it's funny because Thomas was talking about the email that he had sent to you and I, and we were in a profound conversation about it. And I think it was one of the news sources, or I read it somewhere, but essentially they were saying that Afeni Shakur was fiercely protective of her son's estate due to all of the financial issues that the music industry presented to him throughout his career and after his death. And they said that she made incredible provisions to protect his estate. They didn't give the details, but they said that she was just as fierce in protecting his estate after her death as she was in her life. So I don't think, and hopefully she was successful in completing everything she wanted to do to protect it. But from what they were saying, I don't think white supremacists will have the kind of access to his estate that we might assume just based on her forward thinking. And hopefully I can find out more about it, and I'll shoot you the articles that I think I did. Send them to my email, so I'll just shoot them to you as well, that I've read. And then also, it was just interesting in our discussion about Dr. Shakur. I was looking at the timing of her passing, and she, Tupac died in 1996. She died in 2016, which is exactly 20 years from her son, the date of her son's murder as far as the years. The Panther 21 were indicted on April 2nd, 1969. She represented herself, and as a result of her brilliant trial presentation, all the 21, like you said, were acquitted, and they were acquitted on May 21st, 1971. And she is now deceased on May 2nd, 2016. And Thomas had brought up in the email correspondence that one of Tupac's biggest songs was Dear Mama, and we're coming upon Mother's Day. So again, thinking of John Patash and Dr. Umar Johnson, yourself, and some of the other callers, just looking at the timing of her passing, it's very close to the significance of those events. As a result, I don't know how natural that heart attack was. I know that there are substances that the CIA and other organizations can create that can facilitate immediate catastrophic aneurysm as well as massive heart attack. So, you know, God forbid that was what caused it. And then like you were saying before, it could also have just been the stress of all of the stuff that they had put her through by having all of these people who she trusted, who turned out to be agents of some sort, agent provocateurs that were sent to destroy her and also destroy her relationship with her son. So I just wish that she rests in power and that the ancestors lift her up. And thanks for taking my call, guys. I appreciate it.
For sure. For sure. Before I nab the other folks who dialed in, the International Business Times, they were just talking about her efforts to protect the estate of her son. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it just one paragraph. It says, while it remains unclear whether they're calling her by her first name in the report. I just find that extraordinarily tacky. Even if she was still alive, I find that extraordinarily tacky. I don't think the person who wrote this article, Caitlin Hitt, I seriously doubt that this is like Dr. Shakur's like homie or pal. I seriously doubt that she knows her like on a personal level to just be calling a black person by their first name and taking that sort of liberty. I just find it extremely tacky and likely just an act of white supremacy. At any rate, while it remains unclear whether Shakur had codified her final wishes, she did make sure her son was protected. According to TMZ, that's not the best source, but Tupac's mother created a trust that controlled all of the California Love rappers' music rights. A rep for the West Coast Rappers Estate says, they did it again, Shakur was careful when writing up the paperwork, leaving nothing to chance. She even went as far as choosing an executor for the slain musician's music rights, naming former Warner Brothers executive Tom Whaley. The trust outlines heirs to Tupac's fortune, naming charities and family members that Afeni selected to inherit a portion. So it looks like she might have done her diligence in advance, which is outstanding illustration of black self-respect, black mother on her job. If she was able to get all that done before her transition. The other folks who dialed in, Lashes, did you have commentary? You should be with us.
Hello.
Yes,
hi,
ma'am.
Lashes. In regards to your comment about Trump being the possible prospect of becoming the president, as the way this whole election process is going on for the GOP and the Democratic team, so to speak, this is an open primary, so nothing has been finalized as of yet. In regards to the GOP, they, the committee, are not satisfied with Trump as the nominee at the point. So when it comes to the convention time, they can pop up any other candidate that the GOP committee feels like, you know, I'd rather have this person best represent the party over Trump. So it's still interesting how everything's going to play out come the final day of the convention for both parties. So don't hold, you know, hold out for final, you know, conclusions on who will be president, because this is just so up in the air this year. I've never seen an election like this in my lifetime ever.
Me either.
This can go either way. Each party, both parties can prop up anyone that is not currently running for the Democratic or what was the Republican nominee or nomination. They can still prop up anyone because it's an open primary. Not a closed one. That's all I wanted to say.
Right on. Yeah, I totally agree. I have not witnessed, not that I've been around that long, but I have not witnessed a presidential election like this. That's just extremely unpredictable. There's not even one I can think of that compares to this one. The only thing I can say with Trump is that particularly since it seems like a lot of white people, which is very rare, it seems like there are a lot of white people that are publicly willing to identify Donald Trump as a racist. Like, I've seen a lot of that, not just within the last 2-3 months, but for a while now. For that sort of thing, I think white people, just in general, white people lie a lot, but especially when it comes to, okay, we have a white person who is publicly frequently identified as a racist. I think a lot of these white people that are saying, I wouldn't vote for Trump, I don't like him, there's no way he can be our represent. These are like the GOP members. There's no way he can represent our party and blah, blah, blah. He would lose to Hillary Clinton. I think a lot of these folks are lying. And I would just one thing that to me strongly suggests that they're lying. I have heard lots of white people, even some of the former candidates, now that everybody's dropped out, when they have been asked, OK, if you don't win the nomination, will you support the eventual whomever gets the Republican nomination? Will you support that candidate? And they don't even say Trump. They'll just ask it in that kind of open way. Will you support the eventual Republican nominee if it's not you? Everybody that I have heard them ask has said, yes, I will support the eventual candidate, whomever it happens to be. They asked Haley Barbour, who was the former RNC chairman, and he was a former governor of Mississippi. He was governor at the time that the Scott sisters were incarcerated. If folks remember that case back like 2011. But they asked him the same question. Would you support the eventual nominee? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like even the people that have come out and they, you know, given their long soliloquy for like a half hour. Donald Trump is the worst in the world. He's racist. His skin complexion is funny. I hate him. His fingernails are dirty. Would you support him if he's the eventual nominee? Either they have said yes. And I think I've only heard one person and they didn't even say no. They just said, oh, well, I can't really comment on something that's that far down the road. I mean, we're talking about something that's in November. It's still springtime, so you have to ask me down the road. Just that right there, I strongly suspect that a lot of these white people that are saying that they wouldn't vote for him and they don't like him and they can't stand him, they're lying.
Someone actually made the same comment too. He was the former mayor of, in, I think it was Louisiana, the Indian guy. I forgot his name.
Bobby Jindal.
Oh, yeah, him.
Oh, okay.
He was posed the same question too on air today, and he said, I don't like Trump. You know, he's this, that, and the third, but if he's the only Republican candidate to choose from, I'm going to vote with my party line.
He was former governor.
And he said
wasn't
that on
he?
The air. Governor, mayor, whoever.
right.
Yeah. Say he said he will vote according to his party line. So, that, even though he's non white, but that's just a example of the motif you're bringing up in terms of other white people who are saying they wouldn't do it, but there's a good chance that they would do it. And I also heard the same comments from white people on the Blaine Lehrer show on WNYC during the whole Brooklyn primary, New York primary fiasco, where a lot of voters weren't able to vote in Brooklyn, but some white folks did call in. They were kind of like hesitant to say who they were going to vote for. Like one woman came on the air, told me she's going to vote for XYZ. She called back in to share her updates on how the whole election voting booth process went. And the host, Brian Lehrer, asked her, you know, who did you vote for? Did you vote for who you say you're going to vote for? She said, I'd rather not say. I got into the booth and, I changed my mind, but I'd rather not disclose. I was like, wow, okay. So that was really interesting, but yeah.
white people, they have a term that they codify for that. It's not the best term, but it's called the Bradley effect. I say it's not the best term because it's named after a black person who's running for governor in California in the 80s. And they did all the projections before the election. I think he was running for governor. They did all the projections before, and he was leading. They thought he was going to win, and then the election came, and he lost. And their theory was that a lot of the white people, when polled and asked who they were going to vote for, they said they were going to vote for this black guy. But then once they got in the booth, they did not. They voted for the white guy. And so they said that that's one of the ways that racism plays out, that you had a lot of white people who did not want to be implicated as racist because they weren't supporting the black guy. So they just lied and said they were going to vote for him, and then they did not. Even though the term is not accurate, I think that same concept is in play here, where you have white people who do not want to be publicly implicated as racist will say bad things about Donald Trump, and will talk about him really, really bad for an hour or months, but they will vote for him when it comes down to November. That's strongly my theory. And just the fact that Hillary Clinton, in my view, who is it going to be if it's not Donald Trump? Everybody has dropped out of the race. There is nobody else but him.
But that's the whole point. It's an open primary. They can prop up anyone that wasn't running in the public eye.
Okay.
It could be anyone. We have no idea. Some people are speculating it could be Ryan. Some people are speculating it could be Mitt Romney all over again. Who knows? This is such an, when I say open, I mean, they can throw a wild card at any given moment.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying in regards to the fact that it's an open primary. Now, back to the Bradley term you use, the Bradley effect. The concept itself kind of reminds me of how, like, white people use the term, historically speaking, the term Indian giver, same concept, wrong term, or when they want to use the word nigger in a certain context, same concept, but, you know, bad term. You know what I mean?
Totally, totally, totally. And it keeps the focus on the dark people as opposed to whites practicing racism. It still puts the focus on a black person, Bradley effect or Indian giver, as opposed to white giver or racist giver, whatever, however it would be accurately named.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard people say that as well. Paul Ryan came out publicly and said that he would not accept the presidential nomination because a lot of people were saying House Speaker Ryan that they wanted him to run, that they think he could do it. And he's already come out and publicly said that he does not intend to run this time. And I think Mitt Romney has as well said that that would be like a two-time loser, but he already, I think, announced as well that he wouldn't run. That's why I'm saying who would be all of the people that I think other options at this point, they have declined. And I'm just looking at the delegates. Like, that's one thing I would tell folks who are not interested in getting caught up in the political theater of all of this. Just bypass all of the commentary and look at the delegate count. Trump is killing them on the delegate. Mm-hmm. Like, even the people who were saying that they don't think he's going to get enough delegates, that this will be some sort of brawl at the Republican convention, they're wrong. He is going to get the delegates easily. That's why I said the last 2 weeks, he throttled them. I was stunned. Like, it was not even close. He is totally going to get the delegates. This is not going to be something we got to go and wrangle. And he is going to get the delegates. And I have no idea how you are not going to pick the candidate who did secure enough delegates to win the nomination outright. I have no idea how you would not pick him. He clearly has enough support, and I think white people are going to vote for him. We have to see how it plays out because it has been unusual. But all the confusion around it, where they're trying to make it seem like this guy is not a respectable candidate and he's a buffoon and blah, blah, blah. And Bill Maher, particularly the my BFF, Amy Goodman, Bill Maher, I think those type of white people, and said, oh, my God, this guy is a disgrace. And they will really go to work to make it seem like there's no way this guy can win. And we got to get Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or anybody. But this guy, they will really do a great job to make it seem like he is not an acceptable candidate. He is not legitimate for this office. At the end of the day, system of white supremacy, I would totally, if I had to put money down, I would take Trump.
To be honest with you, if it has to come down to Trump over Clinton, I would have to throw my vote towards Trump. I just refuse to do the Hillary fiasco again. I can't. She just, oh my God, her track record is just deplorable, especially towards black people. I just can't do it. And she, oh, I can't. I'd rather just deal with the devil I know, the narcissist, flamboyant carpetbagger from New York, over a Clinton, Hillary Rodham. It's just horrible. She's like, she reminds me of Margaret Thatcher, like, but 10 times worse. I just can't. I can't. I just know the U.S. would definitely go to war with her in office, for sure. Hands down.
I suspect, at least I get the impression, just by the fact that she hasn't wrapped up the nomination, I suspect that there are a lot of people who feel the same as you. Obviously not white people, but I suspect that there are a lot of people who feel the same as you. Just for me, I also think it's significant. I think a lot of white people do not like Hillary Clinton. That's the impression that I get. Part of the reason she has not wrapped up the nomination. I'm also not convinced that a lot of these people that are voting for Bernie Sanders, I'm not convinced that once she eventually wins the nomination, which I think she will, just based on the delegate count, I don't think they are going to vote for her. I think a lot of them will say, I'm disgusted. It should have been Bernie Sanders. I don't like Hillary Clinton. Probably some of them for the reasons that you laid out. I'm not going to vote for her, which will further erode support and will boost whomever she is running against, presumably, in my opinion, Donald Trump, that people will not vote for her. And I think some other, this has been such an unusual election. I think some things probably will happen between now and November. I suspect that will directly impact Hillary Clinton, whether it's the emails or anything else. I think something will happen that will have a significant impact on the narrative of this election. And again, just I do think it's significant. In my opinion, these decisions about who's going to sit in the chair at the White House have
already been made.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. This is just the narrative of how we got there. That's the way that I watch all of this. But yeah, decisions already been made. And our caller in Michigan, if you had, she's on the line. Were you going to add to the commentary as well, our caller in Michigan?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry about that. My car dropped, and I'm glad I'm in a sitting still for once for the evening. But anyway, wanted to just comment on the workplace racism, the change that that you said you were going to implement. I know that I had struggled over the last, year or so just participating because of I'm on the East Coast and it is pretty late once you get to that portion of the program. And sometimes, it's just too late and I'm asleep or something. I just can't hang that long. So I think that it is a good idea to do it on a separate day. And I know we're sharing that you're not looking forward to it, but I just wanted to say that me being I've done the so-called entrepreneur thing. I've also, experiencing workplace racism as I've been, looking for jobs and things like that. And now that I'm less confused, oh my goodness, it has such an impact on me. So I see the value of sharing workplace racism. You spend the majority of our day on a job or, just in some kind of situation where we're trying to make our earning for our families. And I really see just the impact of working with white people on the confusion or just trying to minimize contact with non-white people and just the heaviness that it has on me personally, just because of, just trying to maintain a household and things like that. So I just wanted to comment on that I think it is a good idea to dedicate a little more time or just, have it earlier. That's just what I wanted to share. So I know that I wanted to, just thank you for even looking at, considering changing the time and the day. So that's all I want to share.
Appreciate that. Yeah, it'll be at the normal program time, which is 8 p.m. Eastern. So it'll be I guess that's 3 hours earlier than it typically would be. By the time we get to it on the compensatory call-in on Saturdays, it's like 11, probably closer to 11:30 by the time we get to it. So it'll be, I guess, probably about 3.5 hours earlier than it typically will be. If that has been an obstacle for any folks participating, then it should be much more accessible at 8 as opposed to 11:20 or 11:30 when we normally get to workplace racism.
Gus, can I say something about workplace racism, please?
For sure.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, you asked earlier, you know, you people get quiet, you hear the crickets when it comes to workplace racism. And I think that the workplace, we're conditioned, you know, not to discuss things that happen at the workplace. And, you know, I think, you know, we're talking on the show, people know our voices, you know, you have that fear sometimes maybe, you know, one of your coworkers might hear it. And I just had a short story, and I don't know if this will help anyone, but I was, you know, this was last year. I was working at a job, and, you know, one of my coworkers who was black, who seemed like he wanted more information about racism, I let him listen to a, you know, I downloaded a show of the cows on his phone. And, you know, it wasn't a workplace racism, you know, show or anything like that. But that weekend, I responded, you know, or commented on workplace racism. And when I got to work that Monday, he was, yo, I listened to you on that show, man. You was telling them about the, it was the, you know, the managers. I had, you know, 6 employees, 5 managers. So you was hitting it right on the head. And I was like, oh, my God, why did I tell this dude to listen to the show? Because, you know, I don't want people to know, you know, I'm using my name. And but he didn't go around saying anything to everyone, you know, but it was just, you know, just be careful because we, you know, we do sometimes comment on the show very openly and we give, you know, we might tell someone to listen to the show. Now, that same person could have used that episode against me, you know, because, you know, I signed disclosure letters and things saying, you know, I'm not going to mention anything that happens at the firm, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And if you break that, you know, that's automatic terminate. So that could have, you know, been potentially used against me if he was angry at me one day or something. So I just wanted to put that out there. You know, maybe you want to be very careful who you, you know, tell to listen to the show sometimes at your job.
Great point. Great point. I know we've had other people who have mentioned before. I don't think they shared the program, or at least they didn't share that here, that they, you know, offered an employee, a non-white employee, like a cows episode or what have you, that they called in to participate on or anything. But I know there have been people who talked before about, you know, talking about racism with coworkers, and, you know, then they ended up using that against them down the road. So I would definitely, I say it consistently, I'm a big advocate of not talking about racism at all on the job. And even if it's a black person and you want to help them out, that's definitely something to be very cautious about. It's unfortunate, but I mean, that's just the sort of environment that we're in, to be very cautious in talking with them. In fact, I even remember Kamisha M. Africa. She was on the program. She talked about how, I don't think she shared a cows episode, but I think she gave a book. This person, it was a black colleague, and she gave this person a book to read. That, you know, he was seeming like he was open and wanted to learn more, so she let him borrow a book. And then he turned around and went and tried to get her in trouble with the people that she was working with. So it's, I mean, man, I think even when you called in, Thomas, in New York, I think this was 2014, and you talked about talking with a black female who, I think she was saying nigger on the job and that sort of thing. And you were talking about giving maybe some suggestions to try to help her out, see if she could keep her job. And I think it might have been lashes and some other folks who were like, man, whatever. I am not talking and jeopardizing my job to try to do anything. Like, hey, maybe in another setting I might be willing to do it, but in the workplace, hey, it is too hazardous, and you just never can tell what people's motivations are and how they're going to use that information. That unfortunately is very true under the system of white supremacy. So be
that
careful.
Was definitely a lesson. Definitely a lesson. I said, I'll never do that ever. Ended up costing me $7, man. I had to buy a lunch and smooth it over so nothing was ever said about it. So, yeah, that really, really was a lesson. As you say, we're always learning. Last thing, Gus, the
the rules as per the Republican National Convention is that the person, if a person has 1,237 delegates, there's nothing they can do but put, let that person go through as the president, even in the open. It's only open if he doesn't reach 1,237, and he's over 1,000, and you still have the most populated state of California. I think they got 200 delegates, and you got the most densely populated state of New Jersey still yet to vote, and I would imagine he's going to take everyone in New Jersey, especially with Christie supporting him and him being from the area. And, yeah, I just think that, yeah, it's a lock-in for him to do it. And, you know, like I said on the earlier show, man, what he has to do is say, nigga, he got it locked down. It will, you know, just call a black person, you know, get, you know, to get them niggas out of here one day. I mean, it's over. He got it. Because that just tapped right into their pathology. Oh, that's just what they want. And, you know, I think, time to start putting your application in to go build the wall, man, you know, see if you can get a job.
Hey, guys, can I say something, or you want to say something?
Oh, proceed.
Okay. I just wanted to chime in, too, about last week's discussion on fingerprinting. I know that both Thomas and another caller chimed in about them not taking actual fingerprints. But I think in certain instances you must, because even when I got my health insurance license for the state of New Jersey, and when some of my other coworkers got their license in New York, they were forced to take actual fingerprints, you know, the ink style fingerprints. So I think in certain instances they do put you through that old school process, but it may be like the instances where you're being booked and things like that, and the other instances that the other caller talked about where they just do everything electronically. Because that was my personal experience as well last year when I went for my license for the state of New Jersey. And then also, just to speak to callers who aren't necessarily in a rush to speak about workplace racism, I think Thomas brought up some really poignant points. And I was just thinking, too, just the fact that if you look at our ancestors, the most trauma that they suffered and basically their entire existence as far as the enslavement experience was around working. So traditionally speaking, the most intense struggle in racism and white supremacy for our ancestors took place on the plantation working for the enemy. And I think for a lot of us, the trauma that we experience on a daily basis, I think to talk about it for some people is a way of reliving it. It's like a form of post-traumatic stress. So I think for some of us, it's really, really hard to call in and be able to repeat something where you feel that you might have been severely disrespected or severely mistreated in a way which you had absolutely no control. It's like almost akin to being, I guess, psychologically raped in some cases for some people. And it's hard to talk about. So I think the real important part is just stressing the benefit that not just they from the catharsis of being able to speak about something traumatic and just getting it out in a constructive manner and not holding it in, but also the benefit to other people who might be suffering from the same situations that you're afraid to speak about, and yet maybe just hearing your story might give them the insight that they need to solve the problem that they're going through, or might just give them the impetus to actually speak about their issue, or maybe the angle with which they speak about it might give you the answer to your scenario because it's so similar to theirs. So if we could really just push the importance of talking, like we talk about the importance of talking to our elders and things like that, which is just magnanimously important, I think it's just as important for us to be able to convey this sort of information, because I think the most acute racist experiences for non-white people and black people, most importantly, take place on the plantation today, no different than it did with our ancestors. Of course, we have the added issues of traveling to and from our places of residence and potentially coming in contact with law enforcement officials, things like that. But I think the most intense give and take of racism, white supremacy, is that daily situation on the job. And I think we should spend that time just trying to impress the importance of just getting it out and helping not just yourself but other people understand how to navigate that trauma, potentially alleviate some of that trauma. Thank you.
Yeah. Well said.
I have a question. Will you ever have a program center around economics? And how RWS operates in that regard? Whether it's stock market, it could be credit default swaps, how they're functioning right now, whatever.
I know
We have done programs that function around economics. I know specifically with housing, in my view, that is for sure economics, because that's, I mean, hey, for a lot of people, home equity, that is a major source of finances. And
along with taxes, that'll be absolute, the next target they get us with. Yeah,
absolutely. And that came up in Andrew Carl. I just posted that broadcast on the Facebook page, Andrew Carl, where he was on his book, The Land Was Ours, which is phenomenal. Now, he is a white male, but woof, that book is really, really constructive. But it talks about what white people did across the country. It's not specific to any one locale, but just across the country, what white people have done to come and take property from black waterfront property specifically from black people. And within that, he talked about how property taxes, that is a major weapon that racists have used to go after black people. In fact, he said that's his next book. When he was on the program, he stopped and did like a whole little segment just talking about that. And he said that it's been so intricate that a lot of times you don't even have access to that information to know that black people are paying like a significantly higher tax than white people. He said, in fact, I think this was like, I could be incorrect about the state, but I think it was Mississippi. He said that they had two different tax books. They had one for black people, one for white people, and they did not allow black people to access the tax books to even make a comparison to find out like, whoa, we are paying like astronomically more taxes than white people are. But that's one that we did last year. It was almost a year ago to right now, spring of 2015. If there are others like specifically, I know they just did a phenomenal report in the Washington Post about black home values in Atlanta and racism. And this, it just was like Sunday. This was just in the Washington Post. And they were talking about how race more than anything else dictated whether or not the value of your home decreased. And they were talking about how black people, if you lived in an area, it's like in the greater Atlanta area, if you live in a residential area where it was 40% black or higher, the value of your home more than likely was going to decrease. Like, and they were looking at from the time of the recession, like 2008 to now, whether your home value had decreased. And they had all these black home, and these were not like poor black people. These were black people who made like six figure incomes, had bought their homes, paid, you know, qualified, had great credit, were still employed, hadn't lost their job, anything like that. And they were just getting plastered. Like they had people, they bought the home, it was worth like $250,000. Now it's worth $140,000. They had people, they owed more on the house than what the house was worth. I mean, just annihilated these black people in terms of wealth. And I emailed some of the people that did the research because these are people at Georgia Tech. One of them I think is a white person, but you know, they were just going through the statistics to get more information about all this. And they were saying that black people who made, like I said, these are not poor black people struggling working at McDonald's, six figure income black people, that they were steered towards more predatory loans than white people who had crummy jobs, made a lot less money, had worse credit. These white people were still getting better loans than these black people who had sterling credit, great jobs, great income. And when you looked at the data, it was them being black. It was not Latinos. It was not Asians. It was black people exclusively. Just them being black was the greater predictor of this happening than anything else. It was just stunning. It was so much laid out, but I'm hoping we can get them on the program. In my view, that for sure would qualify for economics and what you're talking about. I think we have done some others. I know we did the one in South Africa that was talking about how they looted the banking system right when quote unquote apartheid was going to fall and they took out all the money. In my view, I think even the author that was on, Sylvia Vollenhoven, she was talking about that, where she was saying that a lot of people felt that this was like deliberately, we'll just take all the money out. So now that these niggers, when they come to power, they won't have any finance to hide. This was not like $5 or 10. This was like billions of dollars that they just stole. And nobody was prosecuted, no investigation. She tried to do a documentary on all this, and she couldn't even get the documentary to air on SABC. If there are other specific like programs, like specific things that you would like covered, if you can maybe give a suggestion about the topic and or someone that you think would be good to have on to discuss.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll do my research.
Okie doke. That essay in the Washington Post, though, it sounds right in line with what you're talking about, though. That I would highly recommend it. As I said, I am trying to follow up to get some of the folks who did the research at Georgia Tech about all this, because as someone who used to live in Atlanta, it was stunning just seeing what these black people were going through. And as these were not poor, struggling black people. These were black people who had money, and they are just being totally annihilated economically. And it is the only thing I wish they had included was Forsyth, Georgia, because that's where they had one of the racial cleansings. We did a program on that already. Elliot Jaspin, Buried in the Bitter Water, where black people did own property in Forsyth, Georgia. White people came in, they killed the black people, they evicted the black people, took over the property, and now this is like a wealthy, prosperous area, and there was never any compensation for this. This was like massive act of terrorism and just total destruction of black wealth, and he talks about it in his book. I wish they had included that to tie in additionally, because it's not like black people just could go anywhere they wanted to in Georgia, of all places, and decide to buy property, own property, live here, or even rent here. It's not like they had access to do that. They were funneled into specific places that they could buy, own property, and in those specific places, they've been hit especially hard by their property values and what have you, the black people that are there. The person, victim, did you have a commentary you wanted to get in as well? You should be with us.
Yes, good evening, everyone. I had a lot of things, but I guess I'll go in this direction. So I know I still participate in things that could be viewed as, you know, non-constructive, you know, so, you know, I look on YouTube sometimes and view some of the videos. I saw Russell Simmons comments about, you know, the entertainment industry, saying that, you know, blacks aren't in charge of anything in the entertainment industry. And, you know, and sometimes I'm just so compelled, even though I probably shouldn't and probably doesn't. Again, it might be non-constructive, but, you know, I'm compelled to comment because, you know, I view some of the comments just to see, get a view. I know there's a lot of so-called trolls and, you know, of course, racist white people that come in and just try to stir up things. And then there's a lot of course, confused black people on there that make comments. So I get on, I'm compelled to make a comment. So every now and then I do make a comment and I feel like I'm really, you know, accomplishing something or doing something, you know, bringing some type of clarity to, you know, the situation, you know, the video and the comments. And, you know, I typed up a little, you know, mini paragraph, which, of course, was addressing racism and, you know, I posted it. And then, you know, I went back and viewed it later. And, of course, my comment is, I don't even see my comment. I'm like, where is my little post that, you know, I thought I was, you know, doing something. Again, it's probably not constructive, but, yeah, it's just like, wow, I believe that, of course, you know, YouTube, they're probably censoring and getting rid of anything that, or the person who owned the video, I don't know, they can, you know, just get rid of comments that, you know, trying to provide some type of clarity to, you know, confuse the victims. I did have some workplace. I wonder if that has happened to, has anyone of the callers, anything has have experienced that as well. Also, I did have some workplace racism that I wanted to share last week, but I was unable to, some type of technical difficulties with the internet. But, you know, just a couple small things. Well, not small, they're racist things. I had a, you know, coworker, white male. You know, I noticed again that he had cut his hair off very low, and I was like, man, you know, you cut your hair off really low. And he was like, yeah, you know, again, I just came from that Trump rally. And then I was like, oh, okay. And then he did a little, I guess, a Heil Hitler salute, you know, just raising his hand in the air. And, you know, I just kind of went on about my business. Also, you know, I have a white female on my job. I want to say she might be in her mid to late 40s or whatever. She has the appearance, I would, you know, kind of think that she's a anti-sexual or lesbian or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, I had a little conflict with her a while back. But just, you know, I think the day after Prince transitioned, she kept talking to a younger black girl that works in an office next door just kept dragging her into her office, again, which is right across the hall, and just playing Prince songs for her because she's a younger black female. And she was just like, oh, my God, I just love Prince. I'm so sad. You know, she just kind of wasted. I don't know. I feel like she just wasted the time of this young black female. And, of course, pouring out this fake sympathy over, a dead black person or whatever. A white female asked me, she was like, hey, what's up? You got any lotion? I know you brothers, you know, always carry lotion with you. And I'm like, no, you know what I mean? So, and I have a few other incidents that I'll maybe share, this Saturday, maybe. And that'll be it. Thank you.
Brother, that another illustration why I'm just totally done. Don't call me brother. We're going to have whites calling me that as well. The Prince thing on the job. And that's why I say I think it's important to be able to share, because I think a lot of times black people don't have either their parents or just, you know, black people, period, teachers or just older black people talking about their own experiences with racism in the workplace, or just, you know, these, even if I'm not going to tell you how whites have abused and terrorized me on the job, just a kind of in general FYI, so that you can be a bit more prepared. These are some things to look out for. These are some things not to do, that sort of thing, just so that, you know, we'll have a bit more of a heads up about what to be prepared about on the job, I think is so important. But just what you said right there, I mean, I think whites do this all the time, not just on the job, in terms of just wasting our time with nonsense. It'll never be anything constructive about how to cut your property taxes or how to cut your mortgage, or, you know, this is how you can secure a $100,000 loan so you can start your own business. It'll never be anything like it. It'll just be nonsense. You know, come here and let's play some songs. And, you know, can you come in? I found a cocoa, but it's just total nonsense. And just, hey, yeah, Prince got things to do. Well, wait a minute, I wanted you to come. Hey, you know, I'm sure Prince would want me to keep my job. I got a lot of stuff to do. I'm a little bit backed up. You know, I'll make sure to catch you a little bit later on. If you need something, help getting anything done, tasks-wise, job-related, let me know. But, yeah, I'm kind of backed up. Want to make sure I'm being productive on my job. I'll talk to you a little bit later, Helen, Roger. I'll talk to you a little bit later. Just keep it moving. I do not have time for that. And if you can kind of give that, if you can function in that way on a regular basis so that you are known as someone who is not about a lot of foolishness, I'm not the person to come to when it's joke time, when it's lollygag time, when it's less, you know, horse around, we're not going to do it. That's, I'm on task. If I'm at work, I'm on task, and just get that reputation. That way they will avoid you with any of that sort of nonsense. I think that's why that's another one of the benefits to workplace racism, just so that we can see how frequent this is. Because I think we've had a lot of people who can attest to, yeah, white people do a lot of this stuff, coming up to talk with us about nonsense, sports, and just anything that's goofy, just to waste time on the job and to be talking to you about nothing. We had a person that wrote in. They were talking about workplace racism. They said, I've been listening to the program for a few months. I tend to listen and learn and not share due to many black people judging my occupation. He's a probation officer. I've been learning about racism, white supremacy since I was introduced at the age of 26 to Nile Valley Contribution to Western Civilization by Dr. Anthony Browder, former guest on the program. Renoka Rashidi, Dr. Umar Johnson, and Booker T. Coleman, also former guest on the program. Events and, I have taken my offspring to Dr. Ashwa Kwesi, Renoka Rashidi, Dr. Umar Johnson, and Booker T. Coleman events, and have read numerous books by black scholars, but it seems that a lot of time black people don't want to take me as a student of counter-racism due to my job. I could kind of see that being akin to being a police officer. I know some of our listeners, present company included, have expressed their misgivings about black people being enforcement officers or working in conjunction with that system in some way, shape, or form. So I can see the hesitancy, why some people might not be interested or take this person seriously, might think that they're an agent, or I just don't want to be around you, you're doing that sort of thing. But you just continue as is, you know, do the best that you can. I'm certain at some point you will be able to find some people who you can develop a rapport with and do some serious studying, do some research, share information. But in the meantime, just do as much as you can as a person of one. I know for a lot of people who are not involved in any way with the quote unquote criminal justice system, even then, they don't have access to a lot of other black people that they can study with and share information. I was in that position previously, and you just do what you can as a student of one. And then as you're able to come in contact with more people, if you're searching out, eventually you will find black people that you'll be able to share that information with. So don't be discouraged.
Because I have a question regarding that email. What did that person say? That other black people may be reluctant because what?
He's a probation officer.
Can you repeat exactly what he said in the email?
It seems that a lot of other black people don't want to take me as a student of counter-racism due to my job.
Okay, this is just me questioning. If you know you are studying counter-racism, you yourself consider yourself a victim in this role, probation officer, why do you, in this role as probation officer, feel a need to talk to other black people who are not in the same job ranking level as you to convince them about or teach them about RWS? That's my first question. Second question, instead of talking to someone that is not in your job ranking, knowing that there will be some hesitation because you're a probation officer, why don't the probation officer himself speak to other black people who are too probation officers and have a dialogue about RWS?
I suspect this person is listening, so maybe they'll email and respond. I know when I started out, I was not necessarily looking to talk to other black people who had a similar occupation as myself, just any black person would have done. I don't know if he has tried to talk to other black people that are he said he does. I do and try. He just wrote in, so okay. But yeah, I would be cool with a black person, period, regardless of job occupation. I know talking with a lot of you here, I get the suspicion that you all are in a myriad of different fields in terms of employment. And again, I have seen suspicion just period, regardless of what the person's occupation was, for whatever reason. I think Roz mentioned anti-blackness. There's a lot of that anyway. I wouldn't take it personal. I would study on my own. And then as I'm able to find other people that are willing to work with me and that I can study with, we can build a rapport, take advantage at that time.
Hey, Gus, can I speak to that briefly?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I just want to tell my own experience because my father-in-law was a correction officer for like 35 years in the New Jersey State Department of Corrections. And he had actually offered me a job when I first started dating his wife and we had our son and everything. He had offered me a position there, which would have paid me quite a good salary. The benefits are really impeccable, and I turned them down. So when my wife, this is before we got married, but my wife asked me about it, and he asked me about why I said I did not want to become a correction officer. I said, well, first, I don't feel comfortable jailing my own people, and I would not feel comfortable going into a job seeing my own people treated like animals and being forced to potentially mistreat them myself. And I said, I would not want to put myself in that situation. I felt that it was very psychologically depressing. So eventually my father-in-law and I got into a conversation. This is actually a conversation that ended up resonating throughout the whole family. I didn't realize it at the time, but he had gotten to a point of deep trust with me. And I'd asked him, well, what made you join the force? And he had ended up telling me his story in that his family, his father ended up migrating from from America's Georgia to New Jersey due to his father killing a white male who was mistreating him. He got fed up with mistreatment, killed a guy, packed up the family, and moved to New Jersey. And no one in the family would ever speak about the event that relocated them to New Jersey. And then he had told me of his own experiences. There's a very famous, infamous story in the state of New Jersey called The Story of the Trenton Six, which happened not too long after the Scottsboro Boys. And my father-in-law was related, and my wife was related to three out of the six people. And the trauma that they went through, Einstein spoke about this and tried to help them. Thurgood Marshall eventually came in on the case. Paul Robeson also tried to help them, and it became a worldwide thing. And Jersey as a state tried to suppress that incident because it was such an embarrassment. Basically, an elderly white male was beaten to death with a Coca-Cola bottle in his junkyard, and they just randomly picked up six people, three of which happened to be relatives of my father-in-law. And my father-in-law was about 15, I believe, or 16 at the time this happened. And the only reason he missed being picked up with them, because they hung out regularly, was because he happened not to go out with them that night. Otherwise, it would have been the Trenton Seven. And he said that after the experience, that the trauma that his family and the other families went through during that case, that he wanted to basically join the force to make a change from the inside. And after he was mistreated for so many years, at one point he was given a job. He was promoted to sergeant, and he was working very close to where he lived in the Trenton Correctional Facility. And they did not want a black male being promoted to that position. So they basically told him to take the raise. He would have to go to Newark. So they basically forced him to travel like a very far distance away from where he lived every day in order to perform his job, which really wrecked his family life as far as his ability to see his children and spend quality time with his wife. So he had started to realize after years of mistreatment in the system that he really couldn't change anything. So when I met him and we found out this information, this was information my wife never knew about as far as the Trenton Six. So we started researching and as a family, and we actually had numerous discussions with him about more details about it. And he understood my aversion at that point to wanting to become a correction officer. And just my own experiences with police made me severely mistrust anyone who is of law enforcement background. But over time, we got close. He started to exhibit the same traits as the gentleman who wrote in the letter as far as wanting to understand more about racism. He understood that I was very well studied in that. And we would talk about different things and African-centered conversations. And he would just tell me different stories and whatnot. But I just think for those people who are in law enforcement, who are like this this guy who wants to learn more about counter-racism in an earnest manner, I think the advice you gave him is very, very good. And just take your time and be diligent. I think there's a great documentary called Scarface for Life by Troy Reed. And I think it might be on YouTube. If not, you can definitely order it. It's not expensive. But it was done by a correction officer in Rikers Island. And basically, he makes a direct connection between the entire prison industrial complex and the way it functions to the kidnapping of slaves and the transatlantic slave trade. And he actually goes to Elmina Castle in Ghana, and he takes basically goes through a fact-finding mission there and a spiritual mission there. And he juxtaposes some of the images from Elmina Castle to Rikers Island when they're doing the intake of inmates. And he shows basically it's the same system, the same ideology, the same culture playing out in the prison system that played out when they were capturing our ancestors. So that's just something I wanted to put out there because it's done by a law enforcement officer with the documentary filmmaker. And he makes these really brilliant correlations in the documentary. And ultimately, I would just say that's the best route. It's like you said, be a force of one, try and be as diligent in your studies as possible, and eventually you'll come in contact with other people. And if you have a story, if that was your story too, maybe you went into the system thinking, you know, not understanding that something was wrong and wanting to do something different, and then realizing what possibly once you got in there that there's no change in this. I can't control the daily reality of abuse of black people by being in the correction facility. And, you know, I applaud you on the work you're doing to try and, do something about it. But understand you're going to come across a lot of mistrustful people just because of the relationship black people have had as far as law enforcement and its direct connection to the abuse and containment of black people. And thank you very much, Gus, for taking my call.
For sure. For sure. I was going to say, as a probation officer, just give me 2 seconds and I'll let you hop in, Thomas. As a probation officer, that's not exactly, you're not exactly the one that's out cuffing people and throwing them in jail. You might, I don't know what the demographics of the population that he works with, but my understanding as a probation officer, you would be having more contact with people once they are supposedly heading out away from
greater confinement. That might be a position. And again, I don't know the population of the folks that he's working with, but he could be in a position to try to help some black people, even if it's not getting them information about racism, just helping them to try to, you know, move forward with their life in a more constructive manner and to hopefully never make a return to greater confinement.
I agree with that.
I suspect that, you know, that might have been the thought process with, you know, taking that type of position in the first place. Again, I don't know the population that he's working with. I certainly could see some people saying, well, I think a part of those duties as a probation officer, you might have to violate some of these people, too, and return them to confinement. That certainly could be a part of your duties as well. Again, or I should say, although you might have some discretion about that, which might be advantageous if you're a black person and you want to try to give this black person a chance to not violate them. So that is a little different end of the quote unquote criminal justice system to participate in. Thomas in New York, were you going to comment?
Absolutely. I just wanted to say that if someone's a member of law enforcement and they're black, why wouldn't they participate in the show and tell the other black people some of the racist things that they deal with on a day-to-day basis, just to give us a little entombment to what's really going on? Because my personal opinion of law enforcement is there's very few black officers that are counter-racist and doing anything to counter-racist on the police force, nor do I think they can do it. So I would think that, like white people, the best thing they can do is to come on and be honest in conversation and dialogue with other people that are practicing counter-racist. That would be the most counter-racist thing, in my opinion, they could do. I think that would be very good. And I wanted to make a comment on the other people, but I'll mute my line for now and let other people comment on this.
I'm just processing the logic of that. It seems like a lot of black people that are not in any way, shape, form involved with the law enforcement have the same hesitancy about getting on to share about what racism that they observe on their job and daily dynamics of racism. If you're in law enforcement, you work with armed white killers. You work at McDonald's, that is not the case. You work at IBM, that is not the case. I know when we had a black female, she was a retired police officer in Chicago, who said that was her purpose for going to the police department, being influenced by the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, Mark Clark in Chicago. That was the whole reason that she became a police officer, to try to work against racism. And that's what she tried to do for 20 years in speaking up about racism. She said there were times where she was with her white colleagues and had to have a finger on the trigger in dealing with these folks. That is a whole different environment of racism, white supremacy to operate, to then think, now, am I going to come and talk about what these people have done? And even with all that, I can think of at least 5 to 6 people who have, and I'm sure there are others who have spoke up about racism that they observed. I know I just played the clip this past weekend from the officer in Detroit. There's a black female who spoke up in the Amadou Diallo case, who ended up going and testifying about the abuse that happened to him that helped his family in the case that they pressed against those officers. And even worldwide, there was a black female in the UK who did the exact same thing, who came forward and testified about the racism in the face of great opposition from armed white killers. If that is accurate, I think that's important in terms of making an assessment about whether these people choose to step forward or not. And just based on what Roz says, I think many black people, whether they join law enforcement or not, and again, everybody, whether you work law enforcement or McDonald's, all of us are in some way, shape, form supporting the system of white supremacy. Everybody. But I get the impression that many of the people that go into law enforcement, if they're black people, they might not have the best understanding of racism. At least the impression I'm left with is that they have a much better understanding of racism by the time they leave law enforcement than what they understood when they came in to their position in law enforcement. I could be in error, but that seems to be a very common trend, that they get a radically different understanding of what racism is and how things operate from the time that they started that job to the time that they leave.
Well, what I was saying was, the gentleman said that he, due to the job he has, has a hard time for other people that practice counter racism to take him serious. So my suggestion was is that maybe with those other people that don't take him serious, if he was more forthcoming and honest about the racism that he experiences himself on the job, then maybe they will begin to take him a little bit more serious.
Okay. I don't know if he does that or not, but the suggestion that I gave to the mail call or mail person that's writing in saying all this would stand in what I said. And since he is listening, if there are any things that you would like to share anonymously, if you want to write anything that you have observed that you think would be significant, if you want to write, I will read them on the program and we can roll there. Any other folks have any other comments they wanted to make sure they got in? Oh, if Brittany is listening, our caller in Louisiana, Brittany, if you're listening, if you have, you know, a free moment, if you could chime in, that would be cool. I had a question I was going to ask Brittany, our caller in Louisiana, if you should happen to be listening live. Did anybody else have comments they wanted to make sure they got in?
Yeah, I wanted to say to the gentleman.
Oh, hang on. Hang on a second. Some of the other people that we have not heard from, the caller at 4683, did you have commentary? Caller, last four digits, 4683. Are you just listening or did you have a comment?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to say, you know, respect and good evening to everyone, man. I'm from Houston, Texas, but I actually been dislocated up here to North Dakota.
Because of the flood? Because of the flood?
Or? No, not because of the flood. I came up here, you know, for work purposes.
Oh, okay.
I've been here over a year now, right?
Okay.
But, yeah, man, I mean, I don't know if people know, man, it's a whole other type of racism up here, man. You know, these people, they're very blatant with it, you know. And I actually just got, after being on the job for like a year, and last week, man, I got into it with the racist at work. You know, they tried to get me to sign a write-up. So I'm like, man, you know, I ain't signing that. So it was basically about, but you know, it was just like really the whole time I was there, I was seeing, you know, and you got weird people like people just even look weird up here, man. Like they don't look at you in your eye, you know, and it's always, it's like you can see the deception. Like they was trying to trick me with the health care, with the benefit package, right? And so then I'm talking to some of the lower level people, man, and it's like, you know, it's supposed to be free. Ain't nobody else paying for it, but they making me pay a whole lot of money for it. And it's just me and another black guy that was working on at this plant. You know what I mean? And you know, the other black guy, he had real good speech and, you know, he talked real good, so they was into him a little bit, you know. But like with me, I guess and the owner came down there, and he just told me, he said, "Man, this is it. You out of here," you know. But I told him, I said, "Man, you know, I ain't finna sign no paper, man. You know, they were trying to get me to sign a paper about sleeping in the break room. You know, first they tried to say that." I was taking excessive break, right? So how we do it, everybody in the plant go, you know, at the same time. All of us go at the same time. You got some people in there that might take a nap because, you know, I was actually working at night, too. I had two jobs. So, you know, when I come on lunch in the daytime, I would usually take a nap. But it was always somebody that wake everybody up when the bell go off and we all go back to our machines at the same time. So by the time I come out the door, we all come out the door, the white boy, he come in, he got the write-up already written up. Hell, we ain't even came back in the building yet. So he was like, "Hey, man, you know, sign this." So I was like, "What is it?" He was like, "Oh, this is a write-up for excessive break." I was like, "Is you serious?" I said, man, you gonna write one person up, you gotta write everybody up in here, cause everybody do the same thing at the same time. Then you got white boys be up there, they drinking beer. Everybody up here smoke weed. The whole plant smelling like weed. You know what I mean? So, you know, then when I told him that, he said, well, then try to switch and say, but then you sleeping in break all the time. I said, well, man, you know, if I'm off the clock, you know, I should be able to do what I want to do. Plus, I ain't the only one sleeping. So we were like, you gonna sign it or not? No, I ain't signing. But, you know, I just wanted to throw that in there because, man, you know, I'm really past the point. I don't even understand why black folks still working anymore. You know, and I understand that we got to, we still in this world. But, man, I mean, you know, when you talk about countering racism and doing something, you know, like something, it's going to have to be something going to have to be done. Like, I know, you know, I'd be listening to the program. Mr. Fuller, he's a smart dude. You know, and the code, it's a good thing as far as, you know, trying to be able to survive and you know, live longer so that, you know, till you can figure something out. But it's like, what is the outcome of it don't really seem like it's going to really end something. Because, see, the race is going to have to decide that, like you, and I think you even said earlier tonight, Gus, you know, that they ain't going to change their behavior. You know, so it's going to have to be an action that's going to come behind it. You know, and I don't know, man, but I be thinking sometimes, well, what if everybody just stop working? Everybody stop working and stop spending money. You know, that'll do like a major reset. Like, you're going to have a lot of people going to lose businesses and, you know, people just stop going to work just one day. Hey, man, that's it. You know, 30 days. You do it for just like a month. You save your money up for a year. And then on such and such date for like 30 days, we just going to just try to crash the whole system, you know, because it going to have to take something, man, you know. And the more I look, and it hurt my heart, man. Like, I be seeing people, man, like, black people don't know what to do. I mean, even the smart people, the ones that's intelligent. And then you got most of the intelligent people, they more ignorant about racism you know, the non-intellectual people is, man. It's like, we need the brain. We need the ones with the brains on this side so that, you know, we can try to figure something out and do something. But, I mean, it's a lot of small pieces, but y'all few. You know, we hear the same few people on here, man. So it's like, but with that, man, you can cut me off, man. I'm sorry I took so long, man. But I appreciate you letting me get that off my chest, though.
Definitely. I appreciate you sharing. No apologies. I'm sorry about the workplace situation, but that has come up before. I think even some of our present company about getting any sort of write-up on the job and then them trying to force you to sign it. And that's, I think, even the way you explained it, where it started as, well, this is an excessive break. And that talk about that consistently on the program about just being clear about what the policies are. Now, if you are allocated, whatever the break is, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever the break is, did I take longer than that? Because, I mean, for a lot of companies, you have some sort of inventory of your time. This is when I clocked in for my break or clocked out for my break, and this is when I clocked in to come back on the job. So did I take too long, and how much over was I? Let's be specific. Let's get to the details if I'm being accused of doing something incorrect. And then I guess when you started asking some questions, then it got switched to, well, you were sleeping in the break room. So is that in violation of policy? Are employees not allowed to sleep in the break room? And that should be clear. If that's written in the policy, then we should be able to look in the manual to see it. If not, if this is something that people engage in, then, you know, this could be just an arbitrary rule that's being applied to me. This is not due process. This is not equal treatment under the law, where racists do that sort of thing on a regular basis. And just from the way that you explain things, it sounds like, hey, we're going to get rid of this nigger today, whatever it happens to be. If we need to change the justification around, we'll do so. Whatever we need to write up, however we need to justify it, that's just what it's going to be. And I suspect, and again, why I said I think it's very constructive, even though I know this is not
cool. It's not fun. It's not enjoyable to be talking about, you know, how we get terrorized on these jobs and the things that whites do to us. But I think it's extremely important because this, I mean, this is not a isolated thing. This is happening worldwide every day to black people, with white people, just for whatever reason, just because I want to practice racism. And it's Bob today. We're going to fire Bob. And that's just that. Not that you did anything wrong. Not that you were a poor quality worker, but just we're racist. This is how we have our fun. Make sure that black people don't have any sort of stability, and just get them fired whenever we feel like it. That's standard operating procedure worldwide. But one of the few things that I do think is important, that's why we go over the policy and procedure on jobs all the time, and just knowing what the manual is. This is, you know, this is the policy about the breaks, so that we're all very clear about that. So you can just go back to the policy. This is what it is. This is what I've been doing. It doesn't seem that my behavior has been in violation of the policy as it's written here on page, you know, 55, paragraph 2. Sleeping in the break room, same thing. And another reason why I say it's really important, when anytime you have any sort of training, when you get hired onto a new job, I think you said you'd been there about a year, you get hired onto a new job, to really be mindful of the manual, what their policies are, and even ask questions about them. That way you can bring that up down the road. This is what the policy said. I asked about this specifically, and this is what, you know, such and such said, Mr., you know, Johnson, Miss Roberts, you know, she did the training. He did the training. I asked these specific questions, and my behavior has been in compliance with that, to try to protect yourself as best you can in these workplace settings. But that's what we're dealing with. Before I snatch the feather, get some of the other people who had dialed in who we had not heard from, the caller at 8903, did you have a question or commentary you wanted to add in, sir?
Yes. Am I on?
Yes, sir.
Hello, sir. Mr. Gus T. Renegade. I heard a lot about you. Heard about you from Professor Neely Fuller. I have his book. And I just want to just add on saying I understand the law enforcement issue. My father used to be a police officer for Compton PD for about 10 years. Now he's a sheriff. But it was really interesting how the callers were saying that black folks really don't understand what they're getting themselves into when they go into law enforcement. I think they know racism exists, and they know that some police officers carry out racist acts, but they don't understand the system they're working for, how is it a system that's not just the police officers.
Your sound is, I don't know, is that just me? Does it sound like his sound is
better?
It's pretty good. It's choppy.
Can you hear me?
You sound better, sir.
Okay,
yeah. Continue.
Thank you. It's probably the signal. Anyway, so as I was saying, on topic of law enforcement. Hello?
Yes, sir.
Okay, sorry, I heard a beep. On the topic of law enforcement, my father used to work for Compton PD, and honest, I seen what he went through. And all I was saying is that when people go into law enforcement, especially black people, they don't understand the system they're working under. They don't understand the system of racism, white supremacy. When he was working for Compton PD, he would take his work home a lot, and he will literally abuse me. And I think what it was a frustration seeing young black men on the job that he had to put in handcuffs and take to jail. And I think that he took the anger out on me at home. And he didn't understand how to deal with that system. And I think that he didn't understand the system of racism and what it was doing to him, and how it was programming him to look at black males as animals and as demons. Because as I got older, as I tried talking to him about it, he still didn't understand it. Now, as he got older, up to this point right now, 2016, he started saying things to me like, you know, I never understood why I was so entitled to them, and I felt like I was a brother to them. Because I think he sees just with media, and as he gets older, what his position really was at the job, and that, you know, him having on the color blue wasn't enough. And now he's kind of seen the reality of it. So I just want to say that. But my question for you, Gus T. Renegade, is how do you talk about racism around interracial couples? Because I had a few situations before where we were talking about instances going on in society, and I wanted to say white supremacy, but I didn't want to offend anybody. So is it better to say white supremacy, or is it better to say a system of injustice? And that's all. And I really appreciate your show.
For sure.
this, we should have Pam on the program later in the month to discuss this topic about, well, I guess even more specific. I don't know if these are these like family members when you're talking about quote unquote interracial relationships, tragic arrangements? Are these family or are these just random people?
It's family.
Okay. Because, I mean, that for me, that would make a big difference if this is family or if this is random people. If it's family, then this is specifically the topic that we're going to talk about with Pam later in the month. I don't know why that was funny, giggling. But
I'm sorry. I thought that was funny. You said random people. I'm sorry. Just a tone.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the that is exactly. I emailed Pam like hours ago about that exactly what you just said. So I almost feel like you can, if you can be patient, then that'll be the source of a broadcast in a matter of weeks. I guess the only thing I'll say right now, which I think is important, at least in my view, if it's family, and I do make a distinction between if it's, you know, random folks or if these are family members that you care about and are going to see again and you have a relationship with, if it's family, if this is whoever this person is, the black person, non-white person that is being victimized, I think that's important too, because a lot of times we talk about this, we do not talk that the non-white person is being victimized, who is in this arrangement. The white person is practicing a major form of white terrorism, and what they're doing, I think, is very important to keep the relationship and to keep the lines of communication. I think sometimes people want to talk about racism and they want to be honest. They want to go right, you know, down the line and just bringing out codification and their views on things and the incorrectness of these arrangements. And what can happen, what has happened frequently, is that the victim who's being sexually taken advantage of, they get upset with you. And they just discontinue contact with you. In fact, that seems to be the goal that the racist has in mind in these relationships, to isolate their victim from their other family members and what have you, so they don't have access and contact to other black people. So one of, in my view, one of the major priorities is to make sure that you keep those channels of communication open. I call it just banking on racism. They're going to practice racism at some point in a very obvious, blatant manner. And at some point, it's very likely that this black person is going to want to talk to someone about what they are experiencing, what they think. If you have kept the lines of communication open and you've done so in a way where they don't feel judged, where you're trying to belittle them or make them feel stupid, that they don't know what they're doing and that they're making dumb choices by being with this racist. If you can do that, then they might trust coming, because, I mean, they're going to be really vulnerable when something happens and they feel like, man, this person, I don't know if they're married or what the situation is, but this person that I've been in the bedroom with, I think, is a racist, or they did something racist, or I'm feeling some kind of way about this, that something could be, you know, awry here. They will have the trust that I can talk to you and you're not going to talk down to me. You're not going to belittle me, that we can talk about this and maybe you can help me come to a better understanding. Now, that route requires a little bit more patience, and it might mean that you don't get to talk as directly about all of this immediately and at every opportunity. But I have seen where that can pay off in the long run, where they are willing to come and talk to you and you can kind of help navigate through a very delicate situation. But I'm not an advocate for just going in and, you know, this is a white terrorist and she's, you know, abusing you sexually and this is akin to child rape, blah, 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 because I just haven't seen where that works out. If anything, they're just going to stop talking to you.
Yeah, I don't want that to happen.
I have a question for the caller. Why do you want to discuss racism, white supremacy to your family member who's in a tragic relationship?
Just so they can understand what they're up against, what they're experiencing. They don't understand that they're in a trap. That's why I want to talk to him about it, because he doesn't see what I see. And he knows it. I think he knows a little bit. He knows something's not right. But that's the reason why I want to talk about it, because he doesn't understand the trap that he's under.
Have you asked him how does he define racism?
No, I haven't asked him that. I asked him, has he ever experienced racism and does he know about it? And he said, yes, I have experienced racism, but I never asked him to define racism.
You should ask him.
Okay.
How close are you to this relative?
I'm pretty close. I've known him for almost all my life. He's like, you know, almost like a best friend to me.
Oh, okay. What I would say is I wouldn't have a discussion with him because from participating and listening to the show over the years is once black people are involved in those tragic arrangements and the products of the tragic arrangements, they're always going to defend white people. They're not going to get the logic. They're going to look for that out. They're under extreme powerful dosage of white validation, whereas they have a white person saying they love them. And it's no way you're going to convince them that white people are all racist once they have a white person telling them at night they love them. And I just think that it'll be best not to have that conversation. And like Gus said, just wait for him to come to you because it will happen.
Yeah.
How long has he been with this person?
12 years.
What?
12 years.
12
yeah.
years?
Yeah.
Are they married? Oh,
they're married, yeah.
Woo.
Yeah, he's 12 years a slave,
bro. It's crazy how you said, you know, he'll eventually see it. And I was just trying to say he's really confused because that's what the system does to you. It confuses you. So he's really, really, really confused. And it's a mess. Yeah.
I think the only thing you can do is just ask him his definition for racism. And that's basically take it very, very, very small and slow.
I have a question, Pam. It's really interesting how you said asking to define racism. If I ask him to define racism, what else does that lead into?
Well, that can lead to another question for you to ask him to help him clarify his mind. If you already suspect he's confused,
okay,
at least you know
fair.
What areas he's confused in. So you can build upon asking another question, a follow-up question, in an area you know he's confused about, so he can get further clarification on that next area of confusion.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What is your definition of racism?
Hang on a second, because I've said before, this subject matter, nobody gets hesitant. Nope, no apologies. I'm just noting an observation. Nobody is hesitant about talking about this subject matter. Everyone is eager to chime in and get questions and information. Other areas, not so much. Just an observation. And we are going to talk. Pam will be here. This is the program later in the month. We'll have lots of time to get at this.
I'm definitely going to look up on your program so I don't come in and ask, you know, questions like this. That's pretty rude. I don't want to do that to your program.
No, it was nothing incorrect. It's just this is a pattern that I've noted over the years that just this subject matter, sex with white people, is very, very exciting, and people get really eager to hop in and talk about this, much more so than any of the other areas that I've seen. People just don't find them as sexy, if you will, to hop in and discuss whatever the reasons are behind that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we will have time. And Thomas does have a question on the table when we do that program, if you're able to call in live, if you want to call in and give your, or even if you want to give it now, the definition of racism that you use.
Mm-hmm. My definition of racism. Do you want me to say the definition of racism?
The one
in my
that you
opinion?
Use. Yeah, the one that you use. Yes, sir.
In my opinion, from my observations as well, the definition of racism is a system that a group of people can use against a person and oppress them economically, socially, sexually, politically, entertainment, and all. Fields of all areas of people activity. That's my definition of it. Someone that can oppress you to the max where you are left with very little resources to combat against it.
Okay. That will be interesting. At least you do have a definition in place. So when you ask this family member for his definition of racism, it will
be it will be interesting to see if he has a definition. Number one, I would hazard that that's probably going to pull things up right there, that he probably will not have a definition for racism, which that is a major problem in itself.
Do you think the reason why we can talk about it's why people like to talk about interracial, whatever the hell, is because we don't view it as a form of domination, where workplace racism, that's clearly domination and makes people uncomfortable?
I don't know. That certainly could make logical sense. I will say I certainly get the sense from some of the people, at least, that have commented on this program and other programs where, white supremacy is being discussed in a very serious manner and with the tone that this is incorrect. I think you said, you know, a form of domination where people are processing and it seems like they're talking about it, like they understand that this is incorrect, that this is rape, that this person is being totally, that this black person, this non-white person is being totally exploited. I definitely think that that could be the case in some instances, but even sometimes where it seems like people, and they're using terms that explicitly are talking about this as a form of exploitation, domination, terrorism, but it just still seems like there's a certain excitement. Or somebody has some noises, or I don't know if it's a phone in the background. There still seems like there's an excitement or an enthusiasm present for that particular aspect of discussing racism that is simply not there for others. I know Dr. Welsing, this, and that, like when I say years ago, this was like, we had done two programs on the cows, and she said it was more just like a word of caution that she, it's been her experience that a lot of times people, because like sex is just fun anyway, right? Like it's much more fun to talk about sex than property taxes and how, you know, white people are taking us to town on property taxes. Like people enjoy talking about sex anyway on a regular basis, talking about it and watching, reading all kinds of sexy novels and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, that's a top activity anyway. And then if you can add racism on that, I think a lot of times I don't know if it can sometimes sound less serious than what it actually is, if it adds a bit more fun to all of this. I have not quite wrapped my brain around exactly all the dynamics that are producing that. What you said makes logical sense. That certainly could be a factor in it. But to me, it's blatant. I've seen it enough over the years. I've come to a firm conclusion on that there's just a clear enthusiasm. Yes, we will go and talk about this, and even we might even be talking about this as an incorrect act, but there's just not the same zeal to talk about other areas of activity with the same seriousness, the same interest. Topello, did you have a commentary? You should be with us as well, Topello.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
I want to say that so far, a white person has helped me get a parcel of land. I haven't paid for it yet. But he has gotten farther than I have getting this parcel of land that's adjacent to me. And the reason being is because he wants to build something on his land because he's a neighbor. He wants to build a garage on his on a piece of the land, so he wants to make a deal with me to have this parcel or a little piece of this parcel so we can have an even distribution going back to this alley. And since my neighborhood is gentrified now, and of course you know this, when your taxes go up and white people start walking up and down the streets and you don't see black people anymore, you know, all of a sudden this land, this parcel of land can be dispersed now since 1998, I want to say around 1998, it was elusive to get this parcel of land, although it can be sold to private entities but without my notification, which is against their laws, of course, which they don't follow. This white male was able to get the mayor to help him. And so he got information, and I still haven't been notified like I'm supposed to be, according to their laws. So he's been notified that they'll sell the land, and so he immediately comes to me, and so I'm prepared to cut a deal. So I'm letting him do all the work for me. We'll see how this turns out. I'll keep you all notified on that. And I had some workplace racism as well.
In regards to the land, okay, this is a piece of property that you will own as well as this white guy who will own it too, correct?
That's the deal he wants to make because the law states that we're in a parcel
land. So right now the
land,
law states the parcel land is in whose possession? Your possession? Or is it in possession to him?
It was in possession of the city. The city owns all you know, land that, let's say, a house burned down, right, and nobody claims the house no more or takes care of that the house, or it goes delinquent. The
right.
city takes over the property, right?
Right.
So it was in the possession of the city. And the law states that if the city decides to sell that land to somebody who wants it, they have to notify the person adjacent to that land before they sell. In other words, if they're going to auction it off or whatever, they would have to auction it off between me or whoever wants to buy it. They have to let me know that it's for sale. They sold the land without me knowing that. They never sent me a letter. They didn't expect me to know that law. So, of course, they played dumb since 1998 or whatever. They were playing dumb. You see, well, a white male goes down there, and I don't think he's been living there for more than 10 years, but he's been at it as long as I was. And I just sat back, you know, because I know how white people work. So I just sat back and waited for somebody to start building on land so I can turn around and put an injunction on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's how I was going to play the game. I was like, okay, mm-hmm. since you want to play games with me, I'm going to wait for you to start building. I'm going to wait somebody to start building. So that didn't happen yet, but they're gentrifying the area now. So
question to you would be, why, from your perspective, why would the white male want to come to you and join forces to own this land?
Well,
why do you think
he's not adjacent? He's not adjacent, but because the land used to be a house, right? So a piece, it's like a chunk of land that he wants, so we can have an even parcel. He wants to have an even parcel going back to toward the alley, so he can build his garage there. Okay. He wants to have an even piece of land, a good rectangular piece instead of a, you know, the jagged piece. You know how land is sometimes dispersed and they got jagged, you know, it's not really an even parcel. So he wants to get an even parcel out of it. So if he gets me to get what I wanted, he can get what he wanted and everybody's happy. So he's seeing it reasonable, you know, and he's hoping I'm going to be reasonable.
The only reason I'm asking that question because I'm really suspicious of why he's approaching you to be, you know, buddy-buddy on coming to a mutual agreement for this land.
Well,
because usually when they do that, that means that the one who's initiating you for this land is lacking or missing something in their pot. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's why I'm asking these questions.
When he first moved in, I want to say less than 6 months later, he was trying to get that parcel of land. He was already trying to get it. And he found he wasn't adjacent to it. So he was asking me, because he never thought that I went down there.
Because
he was asking me.
Right?
Right. He was asking me as though I didn't know about it. You know, we were both going to go down and do it together. And I said, I already asked about it. I've been trying to buy that land for, you know, for at least 5-10 years before you got here. And that's what he was like, oh, wow. Did he just, you know, he left. And he kept pressing the issue, I guess. When he comes back, he said, look what I got in the mail. They're offering to sell that parcel of land. And here's the price for it. I never even got a price. He says, are you interested in buying that land? And me and you can make a deal. And, you know, and we can get that even set up and blah, blah, blah. He said, if we split it up, you might have to pay more than what I will have to pay for the parcels that I want. And he said, are you okay with that? And I said, I'm definitely okay with that. You go get it done, sir. He got, and so far, he got farther than I did. So, you know, I'm letting him do it. And if it goes down, we'll just pay it in cash, do the handshake, and I'll have a place for my parking, and you'll have a place for his. So that's how it's working so far. So if it goes down, you know, it goes down. If it don't, well, we know how it works. Y'all still there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't drop off there. Okay. Make sure I didn't drop off.
Workplace racism, you said?
Oh, yeah. Now, I'm in a different position on the plantation, so I'm not working outside as much, more of an office worker now. So my job is to deal with contractors a lot more and manage their work or inspect and make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, that we pay them to do, or that the company pays them to do. So I had we usually talk to our coworkers who do certain parts of the job. And so the coworkers that I'm talking about, they do the fiber work themselves. They do the fiber or the copper, or work on copper cables or fiber cables, okay? So we normally talk to them about a job that's about to come up. You know, they might get or they might not get, you know, but, you know, it's in their area, you know, right now, and, you know, just stuff like that. If they were interested in doing it, we could probably set them up to get that, to take care of that. But when we talk to each other all the time, that's how we get stuff done faster. So I approached this one, I'm calling him a white male because I'm classifying him as white because that's how he acts. That's how he progresses. And his mother is white, but his father is one of those dark skinned Mexicans that's very melanated. Okay, so he just starts yelling at me about I'm not his boss, and I'm like, where is this coming from? You know, because I'm like, you know that I'm a black male, and that was never, you know, in the conversation. I'm not acting like a boss, and never did act like that. So I'm like, I'm confused for a minute, and I'm like, is this dude playing or is he, you know, serious? You know, so he looked like he was getting serious there. So I was like, you know what? I don't know what your deal is, but, you know. So I had to turn around and walk away. And he starts clapping his hands on me. And I was like, oh, okay. So it's you know, see where I'm from, that's basically like a threat. You know, you ready to do this is how it's going down. You know, it's like it's a one-way conversation. And, you know, you're going to listen to me, you know, Negro, or how Gus said, Negro. You know, so, you know, you know, it took me a lot of restraint. Cause I ain't that good yet. It took a lot of restraint to keep me from, getting fired. But I just kept on walking outside, walked out the door, took a little moment, And then I went and talked to one of the union people. And I made my complaint to the union. I didn't talk to my manager. I didn't talk to anybody else. I went to the union about it because he's a union steward. So, you know. So that's how I went so far. But that's, you know, and then it's a different world when you're working outside than when you're coming inside and you're working inside. Because outside you get to work by yourself every now and then. You mainly work by yourself so you can sit back, you know, listen to the cows or whatever, and, you know, just do your job in peace, relative peace, you know, and not really deal with people like that. Whereas when I'm working inside, I am surrounded by white people. They don't like each other, especially the women. Their stress will become your stress for some reason. And you're dealing with people yelling at you. You know, you don't know why they're yelling at you. They could be mad at somebody else, but, you know, since I'm the only black guy, you know, you're going to get all the weight on you. So, yeah, so I'm just dealing with those issues right now. But it's going to get handled. They already got the notion that I hate white people, so so you know, I don't know where they got that from, you know, really. I guess the black people, just like the one caller said, you know, you talk about racism on the job, and you know these black folks will get back to telling white people, you know. And you know, everybody's, you know, trying to talk about you, or you hate white people and all this and all that. Just because you talk about racism on the job or somebody doing racist behavior. So, yeah, it gets back to you. It gets back to them. You can't really talk to black people like that. I mean, I do talk to black people, you know, about racism, but I try to tell them a little bit at a time, because when they run into issues, I use issues on the job to describe to them what it looks like. So you know, then after a while, I'll tell them that, you know, hey, look, you might listen to the cows or whatever, and it'll probably give you a better idea. Better than what I can give you. I can explain what's going on a little bit better, because you can see it too. So when it happens to you, or if it's happening to you, you'd be able to recognize it faster. You know, because I noticed when I did that, slowly did that to some of the black people, they'll tell me things as well. They'll tell me stuff. And they got their own codification, even though they never really heard Neely Fuller or Dr. Francis Wilson. And they'll have it, you know, it's like they already have this code already in place about how they're dealing with white people. So they were raised by parents that were also aware, you know, so they already have some of these codes in place, you know, except the part where dealing with white people as they're getting married, you should love who you want to love. That's where it like goes off the tracks. You're like, hold up, you're dealing with them in the workplace, but then you want to go and marry them. You want to see the contradiction in that, you know, and then they'll sit back and they'll actually look at themselves. You can see the wheels turning. It's crazy. But at least I got a white man to do some of my work for me. But that's all I'm going to talk about right now. I'll let y'all know if I got anything else.
Appreciate that.
I'll mute myself.
That workplace situation thing, or I guess that would be another illustration if folks needed another reminder, because you're wondering how the white people came to a conclusion that you hate whites, that maybe someone that you spoke with about racism and suggested the cows, maybe they went back and
reported to white people. I wouldn't be surprised if that sort of thing happened. I think we talked about that before. I certainly appreciate it, the people who have shared the cows with their employees, but I do have a moment of hesitancy, like, ooh, I'm not sure I would share the cows or any other racist programming right. with a coworker. Black, whatever. I'm not sure. Like, I would have to have a high level of real high level of trust for this person to share such content, because I, you know, it's already been examples people have shared that they suspect some bad things could happen on that basis. But with the guy that you said you think he's a white person, he has a, I guess, a non-white parent and a white parent. I suspect that that could be, I think Thomas had mentioned before, any white, I don't know how the white people on your job, I don't know what they think about him. I don't know if they accept him as white or what the deal is, if he might have some questions about his status, his classification as white, that might have been his way to solidify and, you know, kind of make sure that, hey, I am white and I'm going to make sure that that is declared and known unambiguous by putting this nigger in check and making sure that I do that. And it might even be something that he feels the need to do on a regular basis to make sure that, you know, hey, I am a white man and this is how I'm demonstrating my classification, my participation as a member of the white race by the way that I'm going to deal with this nigger. And letting him know in no uncertain terms that he is not in charge of me. He has no authority over me. That could have been what was happening there. I guess you can let us know how the union thing falls out if they reprimand him or, you know, if you have any other flares. But I would definitely encourage us keeping our cool. That's got to be a huge aspect of counter-racism in terms of not getting upset when whites come at us with any sort of attack. Or even if it's, you know, someone who is aspiring to be a member of the white race coming and saying those type of things. A lot of times whites will do things, particularly on the job, they will say and do tacky things just to get us to respond so that then we are the ones that get in trouble. It is amazing how efficient the disciplinary system can work if it is a black person that's been accused of some infraction, even if they didn't do it, as opposed to when it is a white person who has done something, particularly if they've done something racist to a black person. You just can't seem to get any inaction. The union becomes extremely ineffective and managers just, hey, it was a mistake, let's just try to work it out and, you know, get back on our jobs. Whereas black people, fired, write-ups, the whole nine. It gets real punitive real, real fast when it's us. But keep us updated. We have done our 3 hours and didn't even have our guest on the program. We should be back. At minimum, we should be here Friday, Saturday. I suspect possibly we could be here tomorrow as well. I have to see how that works out. Just check the Facebook page and all that. Check Black Talk Radio as well. I'll update about what's going to go down tomorrow. As I said, we should have the program on Monday. Josh Gibson, he's been on the program repeatedly. Kotabu Publishing, black publisher, and he has regularly encouraged people, if you have ideas for a book you would like to write, to drop him an email or what have you, and they're looking to publish other material, constructive material about racism and for black readers. But he'll be here on Monday about how his latest book, How Racism Has Changed the Human Brain, and this is white people and black people he talks about in the book. Dr. Tommy Curry should be with us on Wednesday of next week, a week from today, December. Or actually, I guess that's Thursday, a week from tomorrow. He'll be here on May 12th, next Thursday. That he'll be here. If you have suggestions, I know Lash has raised the area of economics and some of the different ways that racism, white supremacy is manifest. If you have suggestions for that or other areas, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Pam will be on the program later in the month talking about the Area 8, everyone's favorite, about how to deal with family members specifically who are in some sort of tragic arrangement, and kind of recommendations, tips on dealing with that. I know Pam has talked in the past on the program about how she's dealing with that problem on a personal level and some of the observations and things that she's picked up through the years. But that'll be later in the month, I think on the 18th, which would be 2 weeks from today. Anywho, again, thanks to all the folks who contributed, pitched in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Wednesday evening, and apologies for the folks who were hoping to have Yusra Kigali on the program, Black Lives Matter Toronto. I was looking forward to getting in all that. Maybe we can have her down the road after things clear and she has taken care of some of the issues that popped up today, unexpectedly popped up today, that disrupted our ability to have her on the program. Again, if you have any problems, questions, gripes, complaints, UntilJustice@gmail.com. Let me know. You can also follow us on Twitter at UntilJustice. Invest in the program if you think the cows is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Again, I will emphasize, we want to be sober, all about sobriety. In my opinion, that's a huge aspect that would work against racism, white supremacy. Some of the suggestions that we heard, if black people in unison, even a sizable portion of black people said, we are about sobriety, we're not buying any of your poisons, toxins, drugs, legal or no. We're not spending a nickel as long as the system of white supremacy is in existence. I think that would do some big time damage to their system. Yes, just having black people who have a clear mind so we can make great decisions, keep ourselves as safe as we can under horrendous conditions. Just on the driving end alone, so many people end up in problems with enforcement officials. All that talk about law enforcement. So many black people end up in greater confinement as a result of something they did while they were under the influence. That alone would have a huge impact. Again, you never know when it will be Darren Wilson, Daniel Pantaleo, Daniel Holtzclaw, who is pulling up behind you. Your very life could hang on the type of decisions that you make in those interactions. Being intoxicated is not going to help. You're just making their job way easier. Whatever they want to do, if it's ticket, if it's a fine, if it's taking your life, you're just making their job easier if you are under the influence. That is, if you are a driver, passenger, pedestrian, sobriety would be best. If you are in the vehicle, buckle up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. And again, Andrew Loku, that the focus of what Black Lives Matter Toronto has been doing, that's been a part of what they've been saying about him. He was drunk. His blood alcohol level was three times the legal limit. That's why he ended up being shot and killed. That would at least be one thing we can remove from the way that they go about terrorizing us. The alcohol, all of it, the alcohol, the drugs, sobriety would be best. With that, again, we'll be back minimum Friday. We might be here tomorrow. Just check the Black Talk Radio page. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to remain patient, exercise the highest levels of black self-respect each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.